Meanwhile, in New York City...
Welcome to Dr. McMahon's award-winning local medical facility.
Award-winning? What awards have you won?
That's not important right now. Your knee! What happened to your knee?
Some crazy Colombian barbershop owner threw me through a plate glass window, and I think I still have glass in my knee.
Well, that's unfortunate.
Hey, wait a minute. You sound awfully familiar. Do I know you?
Ha! I get that all the time, pal. Anyway, we've got two types of evaluations. Simple degeneration x-rays or... hell in an MRI cell.
I'm sure the simple x-ray will do just...
the MRI cell it is. Magnetometer on!
Ugh, it's claustrophobic in here.
All right, pal. While you're in there, I'll play you some music. Anything you want.
Well, I wouldn't mind hearing some Hall and Oates.
I know. I'll play the WWE theme music playlist on Spotify. Now, don't worry about a thing. Remain absolutely still and don't mind all the loud noises.
Man, that is loud. I hope that music comes on soon.
Hold still, pal.
Oh, God. Oh, God, no.
Damn it, I said hold still, you son of a bitch.
Make it stop. Please make it stop.
Don't worry, pal. I've got this thing on loop. Only 30 more minutes. Again, remote.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client.
Mama Monster.
Conquered the street.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Fat delete.
You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 552 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off. Here for Sunday, June 24th, 2018. I am the Solid Monster. We shot back up to second in the sports category on Stitcher last week, and 18th overall out of all shows on Stitcher. So I want to say thank you right off the bat here for all of your support. I probably should thank Podbean most of all. Probably it was a problem on their end, if you remember, that led to people not being able to listen to the show on Spotify, which I'm guessing led people to run to Stitcher. And by the way, Google, I was told, has a new podcasts app. It's called Google Podcasts. And I am told that the Sound Off is available for streaming on this new app. So for those of you Android users out there, those of you that have complained that I think our native Sound Off app disappeared a while ago on there because A, it was outdated, and B, I had no way of editing it and updating it. So that's why it probably disappeared. So for those of you using Android devices, you now have another way to listen to the podcast. So much news to get to this week. Obviously, I'm going to talk about the death of Big Van Vader. Big Cass being released. Sami Zayn's injury, or injuries would be more appropriate. WWE sabotaging Ring of Honor's plans to run Madison Square Garden next year. That didn't take very long. I watched the Hardy Boy special as well on the WWE Network, which was pretty incredible stuff. As much, I think, incredible for what they covered as the story itself, which is pretty amazing. But some of the footage and some of the things they actually delved into was kind of surprising. So I'll talk a little bit about that. And there is a little bit of classic audio that I unearthed this past week. I wanted to actually use it on last week's Father's Day show, but I didn't find it in time. And I think you might get a kick out of it. It's very brief. It's only a couple minutes long. But if you ever wanted to hear my father curse out an obnoxious real estate agent. Yes, I believe this would be the first time that you've ever heard Papa Monster here on the show. I'm going to save that for the very end, if that is something you think you may be interested in. So, a lot to get to here. First of all, though, real quick, since I mentioned it last week, I may as well give you guys the update. I had my my MRI a few days ago on my knee, my troublesome knee. Now, if you've never had an MRI done before, and this was my second... this machine makes really loud noises during the test, like obnoxiously loud. You would think after all these years and all the advancements and improvements in technology, they can have a machine like this that could be a little more quiet.
But apparently not. It sounds like a damn Skrillex concert when you go into this thing. So what they do is, for those of you that haven't had one before, they give you headphones to protect your ears, you know, from all the noise, and they can pipe in music. You have the option, at least I did, of them piping in music into the headphones. You can't possibly drown out all the noise, but it helps kind of take your mind off it. It drowns out some of the noise. And so they give me the headphones and they ask me, they go, you know, what kind of music do you want to listen to? We've got Spotify, we've got Pandora, we've got YouTube. So I said, you know what? Bring up a WWE playlist. I don't even know why I said WWE. I should have said Hall & Oates, but I said, bring up a WWE playlist on Spotify, which they did. The only problem is you're not allowed to move during the MRI. Once the machine starts making noise, you have to just lay absolutely still and not move. Now, you can move when the noise stops, okay? Because your entire body, at least my entire body, is not all the way into the machine. I'd say maybe, you know, the lower half of my body was in the machine. My head is sticking out, my head and chest. And if you look up at the display on the machine, there's like a countdown. You can kind of tell when the countdown ends, the noise stops. You get about a minute or so, and then it starts up all over again, another 2-3 minute countdown. Start to finish, the whole test is about 25-30 minutes. So that's about the only time you can possibly move, is when the noise stops. You have a 30 seconds or whatever it is to kind of shift yourself. Problem being, of course, that if you move during the test, they told me anyway, if you move, you're going to screw the whole thing up. We're going to have to start all over again. Well, they start this thing, and like I said, my body is halfway into it. My legs are on the inside. I'm stiff as a board, and the first thing I hear is Lemmy. So I'm thinking, cool, right? I like Motorhead. Lemmy's cool. Got King of Kings playing. This is great. As soon as the song ends, what do I hear next? Fucking Bree Mode. And I know that's not the name of the song. It's called A Beautiful Life. There ain't nothing beautiful about this song. Fucking Bree Mode comes on. Okay? That sound effect of the Bree Mode! And the Bree Mode thing comes on. And it was at that moment, as I'm laying there, that I realized what hell on earth truly feels like. It's just like I said on Twitter. This is what hell on earth feels like. You are stuffed halfway into a giant tube, wearing nothing but your underwear and a robe, listening to Bree Mode and not being able to move, not being able to do anything to stop it. You are powerless. You are defenseless against it. And I'm just laying there, just thinking to myself, haven't I suffered enough? What did I do that was so wrong here, like in another life, to deserve this? Is the guy from Train in the other room controlling the machine laughing maniacally at himself? Anyway, they tell me it's going to be 10 days before I get my results. I get a call later that afternoon with my results, so I get the sense that they just tell you that so that when they call you back a lot quicker, you're really impressed. You're like, oh my goodness, I thought it was going to be a week. I thought it was going to be 10 days. Look at this. This is great service. You guys called me back 6 hours later with the results. So they call me and they're like, yeah, we want you to come in so you can talk to the doctor face to face. I said, well, that's not good. So anyway, long story short, I get in there the next day. Somebody canceled. I got an appointment the very next day. I mean, this all happened very, very quickly. And the MRI shows that, in fact, I do still have glass in my knee. They showed me the picture. It's like one, I wouldn't call it tiny, but it's one piece of glass. It's sort of towards the front of my knee. And, you know, again, there's only one way to get it out. I said, look, I am not interested. After all this, I just am not interested in having, I don't care how minor the surgery is, you're not opening me back up. I'm like, is it dangerous? Is it going to move anytime soon? She said, no. I said, well, then let's just leave it alone. So for the time being, at least, I'm not having surgery or anything. I do have glass in my knee, but it'll just stay there for now. And I have to do physical therapy and all this other nonsense. The other thing I wasn't aware of, and then she showed me, she goes, look, if you look on this MRI here, most of it is black, right? She's showing me my knee. She said, that's normal. But if you look at the front part of your knee, sort of by the patella, you see it's very white. I said, well, why is that? I said, I am very white to begin with, but what does that mean? And she said, well, that means you really pretty badly bruised your bone. She says, you must have really put your knee through that glass. I said, well, hey, what can I say? So yeah, that's probably why I'm having all this pain and discomfort, especially when I go up and down stairs. Apparently, I really badly bruised this bone. And anyway, according to her, I won't be running or doing anything like that for up to 3 months. So no marathons for me in the next 3 months. But otherwise, it's healing. You know, it's getting better. And thank you for all of your concern. But yeah, I guess you can call me the Glass Man now, because at least for the foreseeable future, I'm going to leave that little bad boy there. You're not going to open me up so soon. I'm not even healed from the first injury. You want to open me back up? Yeah, get out of here. I got too many things going on. Audible is still offering listeners of this podcast a free trial of the Audible service for 30 days. Using our link, audibletrial.com/Solomonster. If you plug that URL in, you can sign up. You must sign up to take advantage of the offer. That is one free audiobook per trial. So if you don't like the service, if you feel, well, you know, I'm probably not going to use it too often, and on day 28 of your trial, you decide to cancel, you don't get billed, and your one free audiobook that you cashed in on belongs to you forever, whatever book that may be. So audibletrial.com/Solomonster is the place to go. You've got tons and tons and tons of titles to choose from. I've already listed them numerous times here on the show. But certainly if you want any suggestions for any book titles, you can tweet me or email me and I'll be happy to help. PayPal, if you want to make a PayPal donation, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. Right-hand side of the page is the PayPal button. That is where you can go to contribute. I am very fortunate that we have a lot of people each week that do contribute to the show at varying amounts. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out here on the show. I want to say thank you this week to John, Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, the Florida Freebird, Bryant Becerra, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Luis Hercules Hernandez, Raymond the Mountie Medina, the Malaysian Mastermind, Samuel T., the Show-Off, Corey Van Dam, Aim for the Head, Andrew Jorlog, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, the Renton Road Warrior, Taylor Schatt, the Anarchist, Andrew Heller, Vicious Vincent Cooper, and the Berlin Boy Wonder, Marcus Werner. So thank you again to everybody who made a donation this week. Unfortunately, we lead off with some sad news. November 15th, 2016, that was the day that Big Van Vader went on Twitter. I still call him Big Van. He hasn't been Big Van Vader probably since 1995, but I still call him Big Van Vader. He went on Twitter, and he posted the following. He said, "Told by two heart doctors that my heart is wore out. I have been given less than 2 years to live. I am only now allowing this as part of my reality." Vader died on Monday night. Leon White did. Vader will live forever. All these guys, I mean, the Roddy Pipers and the Macho Mans and the Ultimate Warriors, you know, their wrestling personas will live forever because of things like YouTube and the WWE Network and the video games and the action figures. It just makes it impossible for people to forget them. Vader is not somebody that you can easily forget. I said this on Twitter, how, you know, if you look at, I mean, how many 400-plus pound men can you think of who can do or did do moonsaults fairly routinely, too, off the top rope? I can't think of many. You know, someone said Bam Bam Bigelow did them, which is true. He did, and Bam Bam is one of the best big men ever to be in the ring as well. But he wasn't 400-plus pounds. And you got to remember, you know, when Vader started doing those moonsaults, he was already a headliner in WCW. It's not like guys do crazy moves in, you know, the early part of their career to get noticed. Mick Foley put his body through hell because he felt he had to. He wasn't a great wrestler. And so what do you do to get attention? You throw yourself off the apron onto the exposed concrete floor. You tell people to just, you know, legit rough you up. You take crazy bumps. So you would think a guy like Vader, maybe he was doing it to get noticed. No, Vader was already a world champion many times over when he started busting out moonsaults in these big matches. He didn't have to do it. I mean, it reminds me of Big Show telling the story of when he used to do moves off the top rope in WCW. You know, he used to do like missile drop kicks. I don't think he ever tried a moonsault, but he would do stuff off the top rope. And I think it might have been Hogan who went to him and said, "Stop, you're a giant. You shouldn't be doing moves off the top rope." Well, you know, Vader said, "Fuck that." Vader was a tough guy. The famous match, of course, with Stan Hansen in Japan got a lot of play this week on social media. People were talking about it. His failed run in WWE, I call it failed. I mean, he had some success, but let's be honest. I mean, Vader as a headliner was a failed experiment in WWE. Which, by the way, WWE being the only place that he was never truly the top guy. He was the top guy at some point everywhere else that he went, across multiple continents, but somehow WWE could not get it right with Vader. But the match with Hansen, where Hansen popped his eye out of his socket, what did Vader do? He pulled his mask off and he pushed that shit back in, and he continued the match. That's badass. I can remember watching him in WCW. I mean, I wasn't much of a WCW fan at that time in the early 90s. I was sort of forced into watching it when I would be at my grandparents' house on Saturdays. They had cable, we didn't. And my grandfather would always watch WCW Saturday night, and there was Vader, and he scared the shit out of me. You know, he scared a lot of kids back then. He probably scared a lot of adults, too, when they saw their names opposite his on the board backstage, which I actually think is something that's missing in wrestling these days. A guy in New Japan like a Minoru Suzuki is pretty terrifying, but he's no monster like Vader was. There's no one in WWE right now who can scare you the way that Vader did, not even Brock Lesnar. Lesnar may be the closest thing, which is why he still kind of sort of feels special, but there's no one like Vader anywhere up and down that roster. Vader was stiff. He hurt a lot of people. I'm not saying that I miss that, or that we should have more people injuring others, but, you know, he was a stiff worker who hurt people, and he broke a guy's back once on a powerbomb, and he damn near killed Mick Foley, even if Foley did ask him to do it. He beat him half to death in those matches they had in WCW. Those matches, though, are arguably what put Foley on the map. And Foley posted his own Facebook blog this week about Vader's passing. He was very close with him. He was very upset that Vader never got inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame before his death. The Hall of Fame meant a lot to Vader. You know, for all the joking that's done about what the Hall of Fame does or doesn't mean, as fans, right, we have those discussions and debates about what it actually means. To Vader, it meant something. And he badly wanted to go in. He was not shy about that. 2 years ago, he jumped the gun, and he teased a Hall of Fame announcement on his Twitter account, but he never got inducted. Instead, he was invited, and maybe that's what he was teasing. But, you know, he put a picture of the Hall of Fame logo up there, and immediately people said, hey, wait a minute, are you going into the Hall of Fame this year? Turned out he was invited to do the induction for Stan Hansen, the same man who popped his eye out, which led to a funny moment during Vader's speech for Hansen, where Vader wore those silly glasses with the eyeball hanging out like a slinky, to sort of poke fun at the incident. But to go back and watch him on that stage and realize that he was the one inducting someone else and that he never got his own moment up on that stage while he was still alive, I think Mick Foley is absolutely right to be upset about that. And it was the same deal with Randy Savage. I will never forgive Vince McMahon for dragging his feet on that and waiting until after Savage was dead to put him into the Hall of Fame. If for no other reason, because it deprived all of us, right, selfishly, of the chance to hear a pretty damn entertaining Hall of Fame speech. He should have been a slam dunk entry years before he passed away, that being Savage, and Vader is a slam dunk guarantee too. You know, I don't think anybody doubts that Vader is going to get a Hall of Fame induction at some point. He deserves it. He was a big star, made a lot of money, worked with top names, was champion everywhere he went. And could do things in the ring that nobody else his size could do. I mean, if you made a checklist, you know, he checks off all the boxes of what you would look for in a Hall of Famer. He made a lot of money, you know, pretty much everywhere he went as well. So maybe the most athletic super heavyweight in all of wrestling ever. You know, tons of classic matches. He gave Sting some of the best matches of his career. I love those matches. You know, when I did my top 15 WCW matches of all time list, the whole countdown I did a few years ago here on the Sound Off, Sting versus Vader, Starrcade 1992, the finals of the King of Cable tournament, was on that list. You know what else was on that list? Vader's match with Ric Flair at Starrcade 1993, one of the all-time great WCW matches. He had great matches with Cactus Jack in WWE. The match he had with Shawn Michaels at SummerSlam back in 96 was a damn good match. You know, one that doesn't get as much love, I don't think, but he was also a very big part of it, and certainly he left a lot of blood in the ring during this match, was that Final Four match at In Your House in 97. It was him, Undertaker, Bret Hart, and Steve Austin. That was also a pretty damn good match. So the man's resume speaks for itself, and to drag their feet, whatever their reasons were, and I'm not even saying that Vince McMahon had it in for Vader, there were nefarious reasons, they were worried about him embarrassing the company. I mean, there's no indication that any of that is the case. It's pretty much just something on the whims of one man. Vince McMahon ultimately makes the call about who goes in and who doesn't. And whatever their reasons were to not put him into the Hall of Fame, knowing that he had very little time left to live, is a disgrace. It is an absolute disgrace. So now he'll get in next year, or he'll get in the year after that, and his son can accept on his behalf, and this dark cloud is just going to hang over this induction, this dark cloud of sadness and people being angry, instead of the conversation being about what a well-deserved induction. Hey, I'm glad the man is going to have one last moment. This is really cool. Vader was a good wrestler, blah, blah, blah. It's not even going to be about that. It's going to be about all this hatred now towards WWE. Why didn't you induct him when he was alive? And it shouldn't be about that. It shouldn't be an angry moment. It should be a happy moment. It should be a fun moment. And that, I think, is the most shameful part. But when he came to WWE in 1996, his very first night on Raw, he beat up Gorilla Monsoon. And even today, if you go back and watch that angle, which I did the other day, it still holds up after all these years. It was a great way to portray him as this raging, sort of uncaged monster. Now, they did that to give him time off to heal a shoulder injury. He came into WWE, his shoulder was already hurt, so that's the reason why they did that and took him off TV for a while. But by the summer, and I know Jim Cornette, who managed him, has talked about this. He was supposed to win the WWF title at SummerSlam that year, or if not SummerSlam, at Survivor Series. But certainly by November, he was supposed to, at one point, be the WWF champion. Now, I think the plan initially was SummerSlam, and then either Vince McMahon just changed his mind, or Shawn Michaels bitched and moaned about it, and, you know, what else is new, and he got it changed. And at that point, they were going to put the title on him instead at Survivor Series. But in the end, Vince decided to go with Psycho Sid. And to be fair, Sid, for those who don't remember, was super over in 96. When they brought him back that summer, when the Ultimate Warrior, you know, basically got fired, and they brought in Sid to replace him in the six-man tag for one of their pay-per-views, Sid was back. Within a couple of months, he was one of the most popular stars in the entire company. Especially at Madison Square Garden the night that he beat Shawn to win the championship. I mean, they cheered Sid. By and large, they cheered Sid and booed Shawn. So, you know, Sid never would have even won the championship if Vader didn't save his life in the scissors incident in WCW with Arn Anderson. That's a whole other classic story. Remember Sid and Arn's infamous hotel room brawl, and I think Sid was the one who grabbed a pair of scissors to use as a weapon. He ends up getting stabbed himself. He stumbles into the lobby, Vader sitting at the bar with Steve Austin wearing nothing but his boxer shorts. There's a visual for you. And he turns, Vader turns, and he sees Sid's his tag team partner at the time. He turns, he sees Sid, just blood gushing from this hole in his stomach, and Vader sticks his thumb in the hole to stop the bleeding. And Vader used to say, like in shoot interviews, he would say, you know, I never even got a thank you from Arn Anderson for saving him from a possible murder charge. But anyway, WWE missed their chance with Vader that year, I think at SummerSlam. That was the time, if you were going to put the championship on him and give him a monster run, it should have been at SummerSlam. That's when they really should have done it. And you had plenty of stories at the time about Shawn Michaels working with Vader on house show loops and bullying him, and Vader would be a little stiff with him, and Shawn was having none of that. He would threaten in the ring during the match. He would like yell at Vader and threaten, I'm going to tell Vince, I'm going to get you fired. And Jim Cornette would say that Vader would come backstage to the locker room. He'd be crying. He'd be in tears. Oh, Shawn threatened. He's going to take my job away. He's going to talk to Vince and get me fired. And I think it was, you know, so it was not just the whole Shawn Michaels thing, but I guess just Vince never saw him as being somebody who could be that top monster heel in the company. You can't just lay the blame on Shawn Michaels for being a dick back in 96. I mean, I'm sure that didn't help. But at the end of the day, Vince McMahon, if he wanted to go with Vader, he would have gone with Vader. And maybe he just looked at Vader and said, well, he's too overweight, or I don't see what the appeal is, or, you know, he's too stiff with the other, you know, the other performer. Whatever it was, I don't know. You can't get inside Vince McMahon's head. But they just did not go with with Vader. He never reached his full potential as a monster heel in WWE the way he did everywhere else that he went. I think it was Mike Johnson on PWInsider.com who mentioned something I had not previously been aware of. This is my first time hearing this, which is that there were plans at one point to put the Intercontinental title on Vader in 1997. This would have been sometime after WrestleMania. But then came the incident in Kuwait, where Vader roughed up a TV host who asked if wrestling was fake, which is not something that you should probably be asking someone like Vader. Vader thought that was very insulting. He ended up being detained there on house arrest for about 2 weeks, and plans were changed, and Vader never did get that IC title. In fact, he never held any championship in all the years he spent in WWE, which really, I guess it really wasn't that long. I mean, he came in early 96, and by what, mid to late 98, I think he was gone. And he had sporadic returns here and there years later, but basically, yeah, I mean, I guess basically his run was really only about 2.5 years in WWE, but he never held a single title the entire time he was there. He did win a Slammy, though. He did win a Slammy Award for attacking Monsoon, so there is that. But the Kuwait thing is great. If you've never seen it, it's up on YouTube. It's Undertaker and Vader, right? So the both of them, they're on this Kuwaiti, I think it was like a morning show. And Bruce Pritchard has talked about this. Pritchard has said that they both knew the question about wrestling being fake. They supposedly knew the question was coming. They were tipped off about it. Undertaker said, look, I'm going to handle it. The company did not want either of them acting unprofessional. They did not want anybody cursing or anything like that. Remember, you're also in a foreign country. The laws there are a lot more strict. So they knew the question was coming, but Undertaker was going to handle it and it was going to be fine. So if you watch the video, Undertaker answers the question in a very, I would say, diplomatic way. And then when the host sort of goes to move on or ask another question, Vader is sitting there listening to this the entire time, and you could see the look on his face, like, uh-oh, like, you could see the blood sort of boiling there. And when the host goes to move on, Vader interrupts, and he says, well, you know, I'd like to have a chance to respond to that question, if you don't mind. And what makes this whole thing even better, what makes this whole thing that follows even better, is that there's like this elevator music playing in the background. I don't know, it just makes the whole thing funnier. So Vader ends up, you know, at first he's being very respectful and just telling the guy why he feels so insulted by this question. And the host tries to like, well, it wasn't my question or something. And that's it. Vader just snaps. He overturns the table that's in front of them. He very violently grabs the host by his necktie. He gets up. Vader stands up. The guy's still sitting down. And he looks down, he's like, does this look fucking fake to you? And the entire time, Undertaker's got, he's got the Winged Eagle belt in his lap. He's just sitting there, he's got sunglasses on like Cool Hand Luke. He ain't moving a muscle. He's like paralyzed, just sitting there watching this whole thing. Not saying a word, not doing anything. And all the while, this elevator music is playing in the background. But Vader later on, he claims the whole thing was staged by the producer. The thing is, they never clued in the host about what was going to happen. And the host was scared to death. He pressed charges, and that's why Vader got detained. He had to pay a fine. Whatever the true story, I think everybody should go back and watch that video if you've never seen it before. But, you know, looking at kind of the latter part of his career, especially in WWE, Vader did let his weight get out of control. That was one of the big knocks on him, and Jim Ross has talked about this. They sent him and Yokozuna to fat camp to try to lose weight, and then they found out not only did they not lose weight, they gained weight because him and Yokozuna were sneaking out at night to go find chicken, and they weren't losing any weight. So he had a big weight problem in WWE. There was that one pay-per-view in 98 where he lost to Kane, and they did a ringside interview with him when the match was over, and Vader gets on the mic and he calls himself a big fat piece of shit. He goes, I'm just a big fat piece of shit. Live on the air. But when he left WWE and he went back to Japan, which he did, I believe, in 99 and into 2000, and at this point he had to be in his early 40s, he had a career resurgence, and he actually became more like the Vader of old. So it really, you know, it wasn't a case of this guy's washed up, he's too banged up, he can't do it anymore. He proved when he left WWE and went back to Japan that he could still do it, and he could still be a top star and a big monster, and he had this career resurgence. And I think his lack of success in WWE, because of that, I think, is more of an indictment on WWE, just not knowing how to use him other than, you know, you hear the excuses Vader had a bad attitude, which he probably did, and people complained that his ring gear was smelly and they didn't want to work with him. So, I mean, there were a lot of complaints and a lot of issues with Vader in WWE, but to me, it's all nonsense. None of those reasons are an excuse that you could not have done more with this guy. and really just built him up to be this big monster who could have a good run for him. Whether he's the champion or not, this big monster who could just go on and have a big run for himself, and it just never came. I mean, I look at Vader, I kind of think, like, Vader was Brock Lesnar before there was a Brock Lesnar. Before Brock Lesnar and Paul Heyman, you had Vader and Harley Race in WCW. And Heyman, let me just say, Heyman is a much better promo than Harley Race is, at least when the part of Harley's career, at least when he was managing. Heyman is just light years ahead of him in that department. But, I mean, what a match in their primes. What a match that would have been, though, right? Vader against Brock Lesnar. That's one of those fantasy warfare-type matchups there. He had a lot of personal problems. He drank too much. He got hooked on pain pills. He was in a coma at one point for 30 days. His wife divorced him. I mean, the guy just hit rock bottom at one point. And what happened was he got hooked up with the Wounded Warriors Alliance, which is an organization that helps soldiers who have been injured in combat. It's actually one of the things I wanted to ask him about when I tried to interview him many years ago. It didn't work out, but you know, he would basically go around to their events and he would talk to these soldiers and he would tell them about all of his injuries and all of his concussions and surgeries and broken bones and his personal problems. And I, you know, try to use that as a way to sort of keep their spirits up, almost like in a motivational speaker type way. So he was doing some positive things in his life there towards the end. And it's just, you know, the whole thing, you look at it and it's just, it's a damn shame that he won't have the chance now to tell that story himself one day at the Hall of Fame. But the way I look at it is this. He doesn't need the Hall of Fame to validate what he did in his career. Nobody does. Nobody needs the Hall of Fame. It, you know, it's a marketing tool. If it didn't exist, it's not like we're going to suddenly forget all these different legends and stars. Now, I know he probably feels like he did. For whatever reason, it was that important to him that he be inducted and acknowledged in the Hall of Fame. Whatever the reason, it was just very, very important to him. And so I know he felt like it probably meant, you know, the difference between people remembering him and maybe people not remembering him. But if he never goes into the Hall of Fame, and believe me, he will, even if he doesn't, though, it does not change the fact that he is still, in my opinion, the greatest super heavyweight of all time. Whatever your criteria for that is. I don't look at somebody, for example, like Undertaker and think, oh, he's a super heavyweight. He's a heavyweight, right? So I guess if I had to put a weight to it, maybe I'd say like 350 and above. But to me, there was nobody better than Big Van Vader. If you missed it, my Money in the Bank review is up on the YouTube channel. There's a full 40-minute review of the pay-per-view from last Sunday. Over 200,000 views. It is now the third most watched video on our channel all time. The other two videos also happened to come here in 2018. So we're having a pretty good year. I'm not having a very good year, but the show at least is having a good year. We also passed 5 million views on the channel this week, so thank you for that. I thought, just to very quickly recap here, I thought the two ladder matches were very good. I actually liked the women's one more than the men's one. I thought that the IC title match with Seth Rollins and Elias was very good. I thought Ronda Rousey and Nia Jax, the way they laid that match out, apparently Fit Finlay is the one who helped lay that whole thing out. I thought it was very well put together. Ronda looked great. Ronda has picked this thing up very quickly, which I think many of us realized at WrestleMania. And yeah, the whole thing with the Alexa Bliss cash-in, I thought it was very well done, and I was really taken aback, I guess, by all of the hatred. I mean, pure hatred for Alexa Bliss. And for the idea that, oh, once again, they've put the championship on Alexa Bliss. Now look, Alexa is far from being the best in-ring female wrestler that they have. I can name at least 5 other people who are far better than she is. But as a character, I think she's great. I think she, you know, the way she carries herself, the way she speaks, she's just a great heel. She's very easy to hate. She's a great bully heel, you know, on that women's roster. And I've very quickly just kind of looked at the whole thing, especially by the next night on Raw, which I'll talk about in a second. Kind of see where they're going here with her and Ronda and probably what they're looking to accomplish at SummerSlam, and it doesn't bother me at all. So I think people are getting all wound up for nothing here. I think the only reason they even put the championship back on her is so that she could drop it to Ronda Rousey at SummerSlam. So I don't mind it. I was very surprised by the level of hatred I saw online. And I guess part of it also is this idea that I saw some people saying, well, you know, the reason I feel this way is because I feel that people should win it who need it more. Alexa didn't need this win. Braun Strowman did not need to win Money in the Bank. I'll agree with you on that. Braun Strowman did not need to win Money in the Bank. I thought for sure he wasn't winning Money in the Bank. Simply because they put him over so strong going into this pay-per-view that going by WWE logic, you just had to assume that he was going to get screwed somehow. And in a Money in the Bank match, it's not like you have to pin him, right? He can lose without quote-unquote losing, so it's just an easy way to have somebody else win. And I was hoping it would be The Miz. It turned out to be Braun. Yeah, again, didn't bother me because, okay, fine, Braun Strowman is one of the biggest stars they have on either roster. They want to keep him strong. Maybe they did it because, frankly, they just want to put the championship on him soon. Okay, that's fine. Did he need it? No, he didn't need it. Did Alexa need it? What is this idea that the only people who win Money in the Bank should be the people who need it? Should be a new person, or somebody who was recently promoted from NXT, or somebody who doesn't have anything going on? You do realize that the whole concept of Money in the Bank is that the winner gets a contract for a world championship match, or I guess universal, whatever you want to call it. They're getting a shot at the top championship. And I don't know what the percentages are. I'm sure, you know, Michael Cole would rattle off some numbers if I asked him. But the percentage is pretty high of people who successfully cash in and win the world title. So that's number one, okay? So if you have somebody like Elias, let's just say, hypothetically, or like in this case, Bobby Roode in Money in the Bank. If they don't have any plans to put the world title on Bobby Roode anytime soon, then why the fuck would Bobby Roode win Money in the Bank? Unless he's just going to cash in and lose, in which case, that sure don't help him. Sure didn't help Baron Corbin last year, the way they did that cash-in. I look at somebody like Randy Orton. Did Randy Orton need to win Money in the Bank in 2013? Of course not. I remember being disappointed when he won. I was at that show. I was in the building the night he won, and I remember being disappointed. That was the show in Philadelphia. But then they did that huge swerve at SummerSlam and the big turn. And I remember thinking, man, that's the coolest swerve that I can remember them pulling off in years. And so in the end, a month later, looking back on it, it all made sense. All the pieces came together beautifully. So Randy Orton winning Money in the Bank served a purpose. But did he need to win Money in the Bank? Of course not. No more so than John Cena needed to win Money in the Bank. But I think we also have to just, you know, kind of take a step back here and say this notion that only people who need it should win Money in the Bank is complete horseshit. The person who should win Money in the Bank is the person who you want to, let's say, put the championship on, or even if they don't win the championship. You have to hope, I shouldn't assume these things with WWE, but certainly you would hope, they have a story in mind. There is a plan. There is a longer term plan here, based upon who wins the Money in the Bank contract. That's not always the case, I'm sure. Like I said, I hope that there is a plan, a storyline explanation for why this person won Money in the Bank. I believe that it'll become a lot clearer in the case of Alexa Bliss, as far as what they do with her going, you know, at SummerSlam. I think in the end, it's all going to make sense. And as far as Braun Strowman goes, I think there's a very good chance that when SummerSlam is over, he may have the championship. So, again, I don't mind them winning. I don't buy into this concept that only people who need it should, you know, win Money in the Bank, and it really shouldn't be reserved for people like John Cena or Daniel Bryan or Randy Orton or AJ Styles, who have already been champion, who are already main eventers, who don't need it. You know, it's kind of like the Royal Rumble, right? Similar thing with the Royal Rumble. With me, I just get sick of seeing the same names. You could get guys that win the Rumble 2-3 times. And so, yeah, it gets to a point where it's like, God, please give me someone new. But it's not like I'm sitting here saying, please give me somebody new. Boy, I sure hope they put that rookie over. I sure hope Ricochet wins the Royal Rumble next year. No. Unless they have a plan for Ricochet, that's a different story. It doesn't have to be Ricochet. It doesn't have to be somebody new. And when I say somebody new, I mean somebody new, like called up, let's say, from NXT. It would be nice, though, if it was a new face. But look, if they had Braun Strowman win the Royal Rumble. I guess technically he's already won a Royal Rumble, but if AJ Styles lost the championship, let's say at SummerSlam, and came back and won the Royal Rumble, I wouldn't have an issue with that. And that's not just because I like AJ and he's great, but it could be this redemption story where he's trying to come back and win his belt back, whatever the case may be. At least it would be somebody different who's never won a Royal Rumble before. But if he's headlined before and he's already been a world champion, doesn't matter. If it makes sense, then that person should win. So I don't know, this whole notion of it should always be somebody, or you should try to make it somebody who needs it more, and these people don't need it. Yeah, but if the story makes sense, then it doesn't matter. You plug in the person who's going to make the most sense. Big Cass was fired by WWE this week. He leaves behind a legacy of being tall and standing there while the smaller, more charismatic guy did all of the talking. And he was tall. Not much else to say about that. Carmella has outlasted Enzo Amore and Big Cass. Carmella and James Ellsworth. Actually, you know, Ellsworth left and they brought him back. Yet Enzo and Cass are the ones who find themselves unemployed. Who the hell would have ever guessed that would happen? They did not even wish him well in his future endeavors in the announcement, so you know they had to be pissed off at him. Lots of different stories floating around as to why he was let go. Chief among them being the incident last month on SmackDown, where he beat up the Daniel Bryan imposter, the little person. And this isn't what got him fired, per se, but this is where the heat really began with him. They brought that little person in dressed up as Daniel Bryan. He was only supposed to give him a big boot. Or would that be a little boot? I don't know. Cass, he had other ideas. He thought he would get more heat if he then mounted the little guy and started to beat the hell out of him. And so he pitched it to the writers or the producers. They said no. And so he decided to go over their heads to Vince McMahon himself, who also said no. He felt that would be going too far. And it really is amazing to think of how times have changed, that this is the same Vince McMahon who once not only, you know, approved this, scripted this, but he was performing in the ring during this segment. Once had one of his female performers get down on all fours, get down on her hands and knees and bark like a dog on live television, and told her to take her panties off. And here we are today, and throwing punches at a little person is going too far. It's a sign of the times, I suppose. So, good on Cass, on the one hand, for taking the initiative and going right to the boss. But once the boss says no, and that you've now been rejected twice, it's probably best to pick your battles and fight another day. Instead, he decided to do whatever the hell he wanted to do, and he beat up the little guy anyway. And he was set to get massive heat over it. There's another story of some kind of backstage incident involving his ex, Carmella. I think they broke up last year. And I don't know what the incident was, if it was some sort of physical thing. I don't know. I have no idea. But he was set to have some heat over that. It happened in front of people, and they weren't happy with him about that. There was an incident, and shout out to Wrestling Soup for being the ones to report on this first. There was an incident about a month ago. I think Mish claimed it was on an international flight. I've seen other places report it, though, as happening on a tour bus and not a flight, where Cass ended up locked in the bathroom. And he thought that somebody was playing a prank on him. He thought he was being ribbed. And it was no prank, as it turned out, but he didn't know that. And whether it was a prank or not, he was locked in this bathroom. It turns out the lock on the door was faulty. And he decided to basically bust down the door. He broke the door, and the people, the other performers, were not very happy about having to use the bathroom with no door. I would be pissed if I was sitting next to the bathroom. That's the person who deserved to be pissed. I would hate to be that. I mean, when I'm on a flight anyway, I always make sure I never sit towards the back of the plane. There's just something, I have this thing, I cannot be sitting near a bathroom. If I'm in a restaurant, maybe I'm just weird like this, but if I'm at a restaurant, I had an experience once, I think I went to like a Friendly's, and it was packed. We were starving, and so the only table they had was a booth, and it was like the last booth against the window all the way in the back, but it was right by the bathrooms. And every time somebody went in the bathroom, every time somebody left the bathroom and that door swung open and shut, we'd get a whiff of whatever was coming out of there. And I couldn't do it. I'm like, I cannot sit here and eat. What, smelling it, I just can't do it. So I have this thing now where whenever I go into a restaurant, if they try to sit me down by a bathroom, I'm like, I'm going to wait. You ain't putting me there. So anyway, So they weren't very happy with him over that either. And the incident, though, that may have been the real nail in his coffin was blowing off a promo rehearsal with Kevin Dunn at a SmackDown taping. And I guess what happened was he went out there and he did the promo that night, having not rehearsed it. He stood up Kevin Dunn, probably not the first time Kevin Dunn has been stood up in his life, but nonetheless, he stood him up. He never showed up. And so he goes out there that night on SmackDown, and I guess the promo went too long. And I'm guessing, this was the promo they did on that old Mean Gene platform. That's probably why they wanted to rehearse it. Maybe they wanted to, you know, stand here. And anyway, just a guess on my part that it was that night that he was on the platform, because I remember, in fact, I think I did a post-show with Wade Keller on his show that week, and we talked about how this promo wasn't terrible, but it probably went about 5 minutes too long. So it may well have been that one. But what's weird about it is there was also a note this week in The Observer that apparently Vince McMahon hated that promo so much. I don't know what about it he hated, but he hated that promo so much, he fired the writer who was responsible for it. That person is no longer employed by WWE. He fires that person, but he won't fire the person responsible for that Bobby Lashley sister segment with Sami Zayn. That person apparently is safe. Bottom line is this. Even if only half of these stories are true, and they may well all be true, but even if half of them are true, then WWE, it seems, had plenty of reasons to get rid of this guy. It should have been obvious that they gave up on him after he tapped out two straight times in two straight pay-per-view matches to Daniel Bryan. When your whole gimmick is that you're tall and the smaller guy taps you out, not just beats you, but taps you out twice in a row, you're pretty much job bait at that point. And if the guy is that much of a pain in the ass, then you cut the dead weight and you move on. I mean, you never want to see anybody fired, but it's just the way it is. I mean, I thought the match he had with Bryan at Money in the Bank, the irony of it is that I thought this was maybe the best match of his life that he had with Bryan at Money in the Bank. It was much better than the match they had at Backlash. And I remember in my review, I even made the comment, like, where do you go with this guy from here? I didn't want to see him cut just because he had no direction. Just because he was directionless doesn't mean that you should, like, cut the guy. There's still maybe something there. But if he's causing problems and if he's acting like a jackass, then get rid of him. It's no great loss for WWE, aside from all the time that they've invested in him. And I think this is a big part of why they don't really fire people these days, which makes this even more glaring, let alone the fact they didn't wish him well in his future endeavors. I mean, all the signs are there. You just got to look, and you could tell how pissed off they must be at this guy. But I think that's also one of the reasons why you don't see very many people fired these days. A, you have other promotions. They don't want them to go to a New Japan. They don't want them to do a show like All In. I'm sure that's a very, or Ring of Honor. I'm sure that's a very big part of it. But also, they put a lot of time into these guys. And to just sort of cut bait and let go, if you put 4, 5, 6, 7 years into somebody, you know, that's not an easy decision to make. They invested 7 years in this guy. 2011 is when they signed him to a developmental contract. 7 years of him as one of their pet projects. 7 years of trying to come up with a character that works, to hone that character and craft it and sort of, you know, play with it and make it your own and turn it into something that can make money. They gave him a few years worth of television time, and it all turns out to be a big giant waste. It's too bad. You know, look, I wanted to see the guy succeed. I saw Cass, and I popped huge because I saw Meltzer mention this in his newsletter, and I was going to say the same thing on the show. I saw him for the very first time at a Johnny Rod's World of Unpredictable Wrestling show in Brooklyn back in 2010. It was a Gleason's gym. I was there. I was actually there to see a friend of mine. I think he was making his in-ring debut that night. But at the time, and I didn't know who this guy was, but he was playing a cowboy gimmick on that show, and he was calling himself Big Bill Young. Basically, the polar opposite of what you saw on TV is Big Cass. It's kind of like Cowboy Scott Hall early in his career, to go from that to Razor Ramon. It's a pretty big leap, but it worked out well for him. But yeah, he was cowboy, well, I don't know if cowboy was part of his name. He was a cowboy, but he was Big Bill Young, you know, all those years ago. And when I saw him at the 2K launch party a couple years ago, him and Enzo were there. And they were doing interviews, and I didn't get to interview them, but I went over to them, and I actually mentioned that to Cass. I said, look, you know, the first time I saw you, it was your Big Bill Young days, working for Johnny Rods, and he was mortified. He was, like, in a friendly way. I mean, he was kind of laughing about it, but he was mortified that I even remembered that. But when Enzo broke his leg, remember when Enzo, I think he broke his leg, Cass got a short singles run out of it. He was on his own for a while. People didn't know, oh, how's he going to do? He doesn't have Enzo there as his mouthpiece. And I actually thought he held his own pretty well. It was only for like a couple of months. But I thought he was holding his own fairly well. And I thought this guy could have a future. He's still better off being with Enzo. When Enzo, you know, heals up, they should just put them back together. But there could be something here. I remember thinking that. And look, the guy still has a future. Only now it's on the indies. Shout out to Joe, by the way, on Twitter for sending me this week's sad tweet. He sent me a screen cap of a page that somebody scanned in from this month's issue of the WWE Kids Magazine. I didn't even know they had a kids magazine, but apparently they do. And this was from their Zero of the Month section. See, this is very clever. Instead of Hero of the Month, they have Zero of the Month, where they feature a heel. And this month's award winner, ironically, was Big Cass. And that in and of itself wouldn't be all that big of a deal, but the absolute best part is the caption that they put underneath the photo, explaining why Big Cass is the Zero of the Month. And it says this: since coming back to WWE, Big Cass has been causing loads of trouble. I saw that, I was like, this can't be real. But it is. It is 100% real. I swear you can't make this shit up. That was great. Causing loads of trouble. You don't say. It's going to be a while before we see Sami Zayn back in a WWE ring. That is because we learned this past week that he has suffered not one, but two torn rotator cuffs. He was in Birmingham, Alabama for surgery on his right shoulder, the good shoulder, as he calls it. Man, let me tell you something. Nothing ever good comes from Birmingham when it comes to WWE. If you ever hear that somebody went to Birmingham, you can plan not to see them, probably for a good 6 to 9 months. You better look the other way and run as far and as fast as you can if you hear about Birmingham when it comes to these WWE people, because there's absolutely nothing positive that could come from that. He told WWE.com that he thinks he initially injured the right shoulder as early as a live event in August of last year, in Montreal, the same place where he hurt his left shoulder on Raw. If you remember the time he made his Raw debut, he had that big match with John Cena, and what happened? He was flailing his arms around like a maniac during his ska entrance, and he tore his shoulder. So that was also in Montreal. So he has to rehab he had surgery. Now he has to rehab the right shoulder before he can even have surgery on the left one, and that's going to be at least 6 weeks. So this is a surgery that takes a while to come back from, and in his case, he has to first wait 6 weeks before he can have surgery on the other arm, and then that's another 6+ weeks. So the point of all this is that he ain't coming back this year. He's hopeful that he will be back in time for WrestleMania 35. This obviously would explain why he was squashed so quickly by Bobby Lashley at Money in the Bank. Let us hope that this horrible feud is but a distant memory by the time Sami Zayn makes his return. Lashley program aside, I was enjoying Zayn's work as an obnoxious heel, but I still feel like as good as he was as a heel in that role, this guy was born to be the underdog babyface. That's the Sami Zayn we got to see in NXT. That's the Sami Zayn that beat Neville to win the NXT Championship. That is the role I think that he is best in. And look, who knows what the roster is going to look like by the time he's ready to come back, but I would love to see him on SmackDown, away from Kevin Owens, mixing it up with guys on the Blue brand. He and Owens have been married at the hip his entire time in WWE, and even going back before then, from Ring of Honor to NXT to the main roster for WWE. It's time they separate the two of them. I mean, they're going to be separated for at least the next, probably, 6 to 9 months or whatever it is, but I think that's what I would do with him when it's time for him to come back. And I know Sami Zayn has his haters out there. I saw a few of them on my timeline this week. I think he's a good guy to have on the roster. I think he has good matches. I think with the right people, with the right story, and the right program, He's one of the best that they have, and I hope that he heals up well and he makes it back as soon as he can. MSG giveth, MSG taketh away. Last week I mentioned an interview that Sinclair CEO Chris Ripley gave to the Baltimore Business Journal. Baltimore is the home base for Ring of Honor, and maybe the home base for Sinclair Broadcast Group as well, I'm not sure. But he told the Journal that ROH has secured a date with Madison Square Garden for a show in 2019. And the belief is that the show would have been held the night before WrestleMania, with wrestling fans obviously descending upon New York, descending upon the entire tri-state area for that weekend. That really would have been the best night for them to do a show. I guess they could have done it that Friday night or something, but that would have been the best time for them to try to get as many people into the Garden. I don't know that they would have sold out Madison Square Garden, but if you want to get a good 10, 12,000 people in that building, that would have been your best shot at doing it. Well, Joe Koff, the chief operating officer for Ring of Honor, had this to say to PW Insider about the MSG story. He said, "I'm not going to discuss beyond this statement because I am not going to litigate this in the press. We had a deal with the Garden, and they then told us that they were backing out after communications from WWE. We are not able to get any other dates of any kind or in any kind of discussion, rather. I'm expecting that our lawyers will be contacting all the parties involved, and the best we can hope for is that we can find a resolution so that we can bring the kind of energy and excitement of ROH and our partner New Japan to a bigger audience and to a bigger arena and fans of New York City." So it appears that WWE has sabotaged Ring of Honor's planned MSG debut. They wasted no time in doing so. According to The Observer, it only took one phone call from a high-ranking WWE official, and it was not Vince McMahon, because, you know, what mob boss actually carries out the hit? Why would he dirty his hands when he can have one of his people do it for him? It took one phone call to squash the ROH deal, which was not officially signed yet. There was no signed contract. WWE rarely even runs Madison Square Garden anymore. The cost of running television there is just too expensive, especially when it's cheaper to just run the Barclays Center, which is only a few miles away. The explanation I've always heard or read has to do with needing more union labor at MSG when they run the Garden. Apparently at the Barclays Center, it's a lot easier to get trucks up and down to load their equipment, whereas at the Madison Square Garden, they don't have that. They don't have some of those luxuries that, you know, the workers have when they are loading up the equipment and the staging and everything at the Barclays Center. So that may have as much to do with it as anything in the increased cost of union labor, and they just choose not to run the building. WWE does have a few live events at the Garden every year. They have their annual post-Christmas show on the 26th. They have a show coming up, in fact, on July 7th, and they're now advertising The Undertaker, making his Madison Square Garden return for the first time since 2010. It was announced this week he's going to be teaming with Roman Reigns and Braun Strowman to take on Elias, Constable Corbin, and Kevin Owens. So that's the big main event for the MSG show on July 7th. I think Ronda Rousey, even though she is suspended in storyline, she's going to be on that show as well. And so Madison Square Garden said to be very upset that WWE went and announced all of their WrestleMania weekend events next year for the Barclays Center in Brooklyn and none for the Garden. Although, I don't believe WWE has announced a location yet for fan access. They could potentially do fan access at MSG. I don't think people were very happy when they did fan access at the, I think they did it at the Izod Center in Jersey the last time WrestleMania came to MetLife. And people said, I think I was there, but it really wasn't set up as well as fan access normally is. And there were people who called it a disaster. The setup was terrible. You don't do it. You shouldn't do it in an arena setting like that. So I personally would not want to see fan access come to the Garden if it were up to me. And I don't know if they have a booking conflict or what the case may be, but you have a convention center here in New York, the Jacob Javits Center. I think the Javits Center, actually, I think that's where they're having the New York Comic Con in October. The Javits Center, to me, would seem to be a much better place if you're going to have a big event like Fan Access and create your own convention-type event. That's where you should be doing it. You know, it's in the city. It's in Manhattan, just like the Garden is, although this is a little further west. But, you know, still easy enough for people to get to via public transportation. That, to me, is what would make the most sense. But they could. If they really wanted to appease MSG and give them throw them a bone, they could maybe do fan access at the Garden. But MSG was very upset. I mean, MSG sort of feels like the jilted lover here, you know, being neglected by their partner, and they're back now on the dating market, right? They put themselves back in the dating pool, not because they really want to date anybody else. They're just doing it to make their ex jealous. I think that's really what's going on here. We don't know what WWE may have promised Madison Square Garden, if anything. If they promised them a big show, maybe they didn't promise them anything at all. And they're like, look, we have an exclusivity agreement with you, and you're not going to break this. And if you do, we're gonna take legal action against you. We don't know. We don't know what was said on that phone call that spooked them into pulling out of the Ring of Honor day. What we do know is that Sinclair is said to be very furious over this whole situation. They may be looking at some legal options that are available to them. And if Sinclair is angry enough, they could cause some real headaches for WWE once SmackDown moves to Fox, you know, given the fact that they own a bunch of Fox affiliates. Having Ring of Honor as a lead-in or even a lead-out for SmackDown on Sinclair stations is something, frankly, they should be looking to do anyway. Probably a lead-in would make more sense, given that I know a lot of those Fox stations have a newscast at 10 p.m. I mean, here in New York, the Fox affiliate, for example, we've had a 10 p.m. newscast as far back as I can remember on that station. So if they really want to be spiteful, as I've seen some people point out, they could always preempt SmackDown. You know, once SmackDown moves to Fox, they could preempt SmackDown some weeks on those stations that they own. The fact is, though, WWE is not even moving to Fox officially. And if they do, if the deal is signed, it's not happening until the fall of next year. We have a long ways to go before WWE even goes to Fox. So by then, this could all be water under the bridge. This could all be forgotten about. Look, it is a shitty thing for them to do, but WWE is protecting its turf, which they are entitled to do. If they want to throw their weight around, they can do so. They see this all-in show in Chicago selling out in under 30 minutes, right? 10,000 tickets out. And you know that has to factor into their thinking here. They're not going to sit back and watch Ring of Honor encroach on their territory. Vince McMahon is in the MSG Hall of Fame. Vince McMahon's father is on the walls there in the MSG Hall of Fame. It's New York. They were not going to let this happen without a fight. Now, is it petty? Of course. Yes, it is. It's very petty, especially when they barely run the building anymore. What's interesting, though, and PW Insider pointed this out, is that AAA has not one but two holds on Madison Square Garden for shows this year. Forget next year. They have two holds for shows at MSG this year that are still on the books as of this past week. They have not been removed. September 16th, and then they have another date sometime in the fall, reserved, it's not official yet, but reserved for Madison Square Garden. It would be the first time that AAA, I think, or any wrestling company in probably decades, has run the Garden. So we'll see what happens with that. I suspect that those dates are going to very soon become unavailable for AAA as well. Maybe they're just going to try to fall under the radar, but at some point WWE is going to put its foot down and put an end to that as well. It sucks for the fans. Most of all, it sucks for them. It sucks for the fans, but business-wise, you know, I could see why WWE would do it. And James Dolan sucks too, by the way. He runs the Garden. He's also run the Knicks into the ground. I'm sure this is all his fault in some way. Even if it isn't, I just like blaming him anyway. Any reason to get him out of here. But the last time, think about this, the last time WWE held a pay-per-view at Madison Square Garden was Survivor Series 2011. Almost 7 years ago. Big Bill Young was probably first getting his start down in FCW at that time. That's how far back it goes. 7 years ago, and Barclays Center opened the following year, and they have not brought a pay-per-view back to the Garden since. That is a really long time. The Hardy Boys had a special on the network this week called Woken. It was about Matt and Jeff Hardy, their return to WWE. They had a lot of footage from the Global Wrestling Network, I believe it's called. A lot of Impact footage. Very It's very surreal to see all this old TNA footage airing on the WWE Network, but I think it's cool. And so all they do is they put a little, you know, logo for GWN in the corner just to plug it. So they had the footage in there of all the early, you know, Hardy broken stuff from TNA, the stuff from the first Final Deletion. They were able to actually show a lot of that stuff. And, you know, some of the more jarring stuff that I didn't expect to be in. There's two things that I jotted down that I was surprised that they really showed and went into. One of the things, they had footage from Victory Road, TNA's Victory Road show back in 2011, which was the show that had Jeff Hardy and Sting in the main event for the championship, and Jeff Hardy was just all, I guess, pilled out. He was on something, God only knows what. Maybe it was muscle relaxer, who knows. And they couldn't find him. Literally, his music is playing, and Bischoff, they interviewed Eric Bischoff, and Bischoff is saying, we couldn't find him. We didn't know where he was. And apparently both Hardys, Jeff in particular, had this penchant for disappearing in the back and not being available when somebody needed them. And everybody would always wonder, well, where is Jeff Hardy? And Jeff even said he would find new places to hide so nobody could find him. So put yourself in the position of an Eric Bischoff or a Dixie Carter or somebody like that. If you're trying to run a show and one of your top stars, you can't find them. Or there's a segment coming up and you can't find them. Apparently, Jeff found this amusing. I could see where somebody like Bischoff would be pissed off and say, this is unprofessional, this is ridiculous, what's wrong with this guy? So now you've got a pay-per-view main event. Your champion, I think Jeff was the champion at the time, but his music is playing and he's supposed to come out. Nobody knows where he is. All of a sudden, Bischoff says he looks off to the side and he sees Jeff literally having to be helped out to the ring before he walks through the curtain. Now, I talked a lot about this at the time and what a disgrace it was that TNA even allowed him to go out there. It was interesting hearing Bischoff's perspective on it here. He was put in a no-win situation. I still feel the same way that, you know, you cannot allow somebody like that to walk out there in that condition. And it's not as though, even though Bischoff looked over just as he was about to go out and saw that he was being helped. And so what do? The guy is literally about to walk through the curtain. You've got to make a split-second decision. No, people knew he was fucked up earlier in the day. They should have put their foot down and made a decision hours before the show even started. That's on TNA. I mean, all these years later, I maintain exactly what I argued back then. That was an absolute disgrace that they even allowed him to go out there. But he goes out there. Bischoff now is looking at this going, I got to make a decision here. And they actually show Bischoff coming down to the ring. And what's great about this, they have subtitles. Because Bischoff walks over to Jeff Hardy and says something to him, but we can't hear what he says. He walks over to Sting, says something to Sting. We can kind of read his lips, but we can't really hear what he's saying. Well, they actually put captions here. Now we know exactly what Bischoff was saying to them. Bischoff walks over to Jeff Hardy. He tells Jeff, it's going to be a Stinger Splash, Scorpion Death Drop, and you're out of here. And I'm not even sure Jeff really processed what he was saying. He was sort of like, okay. And Bischoff then goes and walks over to Sting, and he tells Sting, take him out. I just called it. I'm watching this, I'm like, man, this is like a mob hit. It's like something out of the Sopranos. Sopranos level shit here. Take him out. Bischoff was more gaudy than Travolta was in that crappy new movie that just came out. So it was cool to finally be able to kind of get a look inside exactly what was being said and what was going on. Of course, Jeff stalled. He was, you know, pretending he was going to throw a shirt out into the crowd. He kept stalling and stalling and stalling. And finally, Sting basically just grabbed him and gave him a Scorpion Death Drop. And Jeff tried to kick out. He tried. Sting did his best to hold him down. He pinned him, and easily probably the worst championship match in the history of any wrestling pay-per-view ever. I mean, I'd be hard-pressed to find one worse. I know there have been matches that are even shorter. Probably better, though, because at least it wasn't long. But imagine paying for a pay-per-view to see Sting and Jeff Hardy in the main event, and that's what you get. Sting's walking up the ramp. Somebody from the crowd chants, bullshit. And Sting looks out at him and goes, I agree. That's pretty bad. They really didn't shy away from stuff in this special, which is, I think, what made it so powerful to watch. You did not get the impression watching this like you do with so many WWE pieces that they were, sort of revising history in the way that they've done with, you know, even the Monday Night War special. When they do stuff like that, you're getting one side of the story. You're getting the WWE perspective on things. Or you can watch something and you just know, this is bullshit. This is their version of events. This is not how it happened. I never got that impression watching this special. And kudos to the Hardys for allowing it and being so open about it. Because for all the problems Jeff had, and they covered them, Matt was not spared. But the other thing, just to get back to the point I was trying to make, of the two things that really jumped out at me, one was the coverage of the Victory Road stuff in TNA. But there's also, and it's very brief, there's one scene in the documentary, and this is going back many years. This might actually be going back all the way before Jeff left WWE the first time, so 2009 maybe. But they were filming at the Hardy compound, I guess, and you see Jeff. I think it was actually Matt, Jeff, and their girlfriends, wives, whatever they were at the time, walking through a field on the property, and they're all mic'd up. And I guess Jeff either doesn't care or sort of forgot that he was mic'd up and there was a live mic picking up what they were saying. So this is one of those like B-roll shots where they're probably just shooting them to, you know, show them walking through the field. Maybe they weren't shooting really at all and it just happened that everything was on. But he's walking and he's talking to Matt about trading drugs. And someone, maybe it was Matt, you know, passing out from the pain pills. And, you know, I'm like, this is insane. And to the point where Jeff's, again, I don't know if they were married at that point, but his wife, his girlfriend, has to say to him, you know, like, honey, be careful here what you talk about because your mic is live. It's insane. To watch that is very scary. And then they cover Matt. And anybody who's listened to my podcast for any length of time, if you're one of the hardcore long-timers of the Sound Off, you probably remember many years ago when Matt was going through those issues and having all those DUIs or DWIs and, you know, just driving drunk and getting arrested every other day. I went on some rants about Matt Hardy. Because it's one thing if you don't want to help yourself. If you're so fucked up on drugs, if you're so fucked up on pills or booze or whatever, it's a horrible thing. It's a disease. And you hope that that person can get the help they need and maybe their friends or family have an intervention for them. But it's a different story when you are getting behind the wheel of your car and you are constantly being popped for drunk driving. You're weaving on the road. You're doing all sorts of shit because you're all fucked up. You have no business being behind the wheel of a car. This was not an isolated incident. This was not a one-time thing. This happened, I want to say, at least three different times with Matt Hardy. And I just remember talking about it on the podcast and being so pissed off and saying, look, you want to kill yourself, go ahead and kill yourself. But you're putting other people's lives in danger here. You're putting potentially, you know, children's lives in danger. But whether you're a child or not, nobody should have their life snuffed out because some moron got behind the wheel of a car when they had no business doing so and crossed over a median and smacked right into you. Because what always gets me about stories like that, and this happened with Dutch Mantel's, I think his granddaughter, and it's such a sad story, where they get hit by a drunk driver, and they're killed. In a lot of cases, they're just killed instantly. What happens to the driver? What happens to the drunk asshole who got behind the wheel of the car? Not a scratch on them. Not a scratch on them. And it happens way more than it should. And it's absolutely infuriating when I hear stories like that. And at the time, that's what got me about the Matt Hardy stuff. You want to put yourself in danger. If you just want to ignore everybody, dude, do whatever you want. You're a grown man. Do whatever you want. But don't put other people's lives in danger. You do it once, you make a mistake. To do it twice, to do it three times, you're a menace. You're a menace to society. And they cover all of Matt's problems from that time period. They show some of the footage is hard to watch, frankly. Because these guys were so fucked up at the time. it's amazing that they're still, not only that they're still here, but that they were able to overcome that and are, you know, back in the position having the success that they're having. It's great. It's a great comeback story. But at the time, boy, you go back and watch this old footage, oof, scary stuff. They even show the diner video. I know many of you remember this from many years ago. After Jeff left WWE and he got arrested, he had his own drug issues. He filmed, or somebody filmed him in a diner somewhere, shooting on CM Punk. There is no love lost with CM Punk and the Hardys, and I think it goes all the way back to when WWE had Punk go on television after Hardy left and basically mocked the fact that he got arrested. And I know, you know, Jeff was not happy about that. Jeff put CM Punk over in a very big way when he left the company in 2009. He stayed late. He was supposed to leave the company months before he did. He stuck around at least a couple of months more just to put over CM Punk. And yeah, it was the company telling Punk to go out and do this, but I guess Punk just felt, okay, this is my job. I have to go out there and I have to say these lines. And, you know, Jeff was offended by this. Like, how dare you? And not just Punk, but the company in general. After what I did for you, and I stayed longer, and I put this guy over, I made him look like $1 million on my way out, this is what you're going to do? You're going to mock me? You're going to make fun of me? Jeff had every right to be upset about that, but in this video, he's clearly fucked up on something. He is clearly, completely messed up. And they showed that video here on this special. They actually showed the video. So I would absolutely recommend that you go watch this. The whole thing is a train wreck, but at least we know for now, up to this point anyway, hopefully it stays that way, that it has a happy ending. It would be far more depressing to watch a special like this, knowing that something horrible happened to one or both of them, but it really is in a lot of ways. It's a great story of redemption. They do not hold back. They have a lot of non-WWE footage, and so I cannot recommend it enough. It's called, I think, Hardys or Hardy Boys Woken. It's one of these WWE 24 specials. Finally, 3 years ago, Mick Foley was doing one of his one-man comedy shows in Saugus, Massachusetts. And at that event, a fan in the crowd asked him about The Undertaker. He wanted to know about Mick Foley's relationship outside the ring, his friendship, if any, with The Undertaker. Does he keep in touch with The Undertaker? And Foley said, no, actually. He's The Undertaker. He doesn't text message people. And then Foley said, I don't want to live in a world where The Undertaker is tweeting. Well, he's not tweeting, but his wife Michelle McCool did confirm this week that The Undertaker is now officially on Instagram. Don't tell Foley. I don't want him to leave this world just yet. If you would like to follow the dead man on Instagram, you may do so. It is a verified account, now confirmed by his wife. Instagram.com/Undertaker. In case you were wondering what he's been posting, not much. He only has a few photos up there. He did post a photo of himself. Now, when I say he posted, I'm sure his wife is the one doing the posting. But he did post a photo of himself with some guy named Post Malone the other day. I'm not sure what a Post Malone even is. Sounds like some kind of sex position. Then again, I'm also still sitting here trying to figure out what the hell a Meek Mill is, so you can't go by me. Monday Night Raw from this past week was in Grand Rapids, Michigan. A Twitter poll, over 2,100 votes, 49% thumbs up, 51% thumbs down. As evenly divided a score as I have seen you guys give this show in a very long time. It was 50-50, neck and neck for a while until it finally settled in at 49-51. We had Stone Cold Ronda Rousey. She was the highlight of the show. We also had a really good intercontinental title match between Dolph Ziggler and Seth Rollins with a pretty, I'd say, shocking title change. So those, to me, were the two real highlights of the show. I loved the Ronda Rousey stuff at the beginning of the show. I loved it. We haven't really seen this since the days when Brock Lesnar was first back and he would come out like a bull in a china shop and he would go after people and murder people. This was sort of the women's equivalent of that. When her music hits and she comes out with that face, you better be somewhere else. And there's really nobody else in that women's division, I think, that sort of evokes that kind of reaction the way she does when she comes out. Now, she was screwed over at Money in the Bank, plain and simple. Ronda Rousey was screwed over by Alexa Bliss. She should come out and be pissed off, right? How many times have we seen John Cena or other people, not even just Cena, in years past, come out the night after they get screwed or the night after they lose a championship and they're all smiles? It's almost like nothing ever happened. That was always one of my pet peeves. Still is. Doesn't happen as much, but it's always been one of my pet peeves. Well, Ronda Rousey came out. She wasn't smiling. She wasn't smiling at all. She wasn't there to sing a song. She wasn't waving to the crowd. She wasn't happy to be there. She had one goal in mind. She wanted to come down. She wanted to rip off Alexa Bliss's head and basically shit down her neck. Kurt Angle was in the ring with Alexa. Alexa had been cutting a promo and saying some things about Ronda. That's when Ronda came out. Kurt held her back. And Alexa continued to talk trash. Called Ronda overrated. Called her an overhyped rookie. After a while, she could take no more. She went after Alexa. She took her down. Kurt Angle tried to pull her off. Rousey gave Kurt a judo throw. And Alexa, and not only did she give Kurt a judo throw, but Alexa tried to attack Ronda with the Money in the Bank briefcase. Rousey basically punched her in the gut, and she dropped the briefcase. And so Ronda picked it up. Ronda used that briefcase on Kurt. At first, I thought she hit him right in the head. I think he got his hand up. But she had Kurt down, cowering in the corner. She is pasting him with briefcase shots, basically telling him to back the fuck off. She went back over to Alexa. She starts hitting her with the briefcase. Finally, security gets in, and Ronda is laying out the security guards. She's knocking them down one by one. So then she picks up Alexa Bliss, and she power bombs her through. There was a table in the ring, because this was a celebration, a title presentation that Alexa had had asked for. So there was a table in the ring. Ronda powerbombed her, great powerbomb too, right through the table. This was fantastic. This is how you get Ronda Rousey over as a killer on the main roster. And when she went backstage, we found out that Kurt Angle was suspending her for 30 days. That gives her a little bit of a break, although apparently Ronda's making all of her shots at some of the house shows that she's supposed to be on, the Madison Square Garden show on July 7th. She will be on those shows. It's not like she's just taking off to go do something and not wrestling. She will be wrestling. But on television, she gets a 30-day vacation, and she already threatened Alexa and said, when I come back in 30 days, I'm coming for you. And we know that Nia Jax is getting her championship rematch with Alexa at Extreme Rules. I don't know if Ronda will be back on that show or if she'll be back the next night on Raw. Very obvious that this is all just the setup to do Rousey and Bliss. Hopefully one-on-one. I mean, I guess it could turn into a triple threat. I would prefer just one-on-one at SummerSlam. And you know what, though? I take that back. In this case, I actually would not mind if they wanted Nia in that match, and I'll tell you why. It's one thing if Alexa Bliss is going to be running away from Ronda Rousey on TV for weeks, building to SummerSlam. Ronda could come out. Alexa's a tiny girl. She doesn't stand a chance against Ronda Rousey. She should be fearing for her life. She should be running as fast as her little feet will take her. And they could get away with doing that for a few weeks. When you get to SummerSlam and they're in the ring one-on-one, you are stretching, very severely stretching the boundaries of believability if Ronda Rousey is forced to have a competitive match with Alexa Bliss. This is what people complained about with Nia Jax. Why is Nia having such a hard time putting away Alexa? She's so much smaller than her. Why doesn't she just squash her? Well, it's going to be even worse with Ronda Rousey if Ronda has to go in there and sell for her. So actually, it might be better to have Nia in that match. Nia is tied into all this. So maybe you keep Nia in the equation. You have a triple threat. You can have Rousey mix it up with Nia. Alexa, the chicken shit heel, can sort of hang back. But in the end, we get the visual, which is what I assume WWE is going for at SummerSlam, and the entire reason they put the belt back on Alexa in the first place, that they're going for the visual of Ronda winning her first championship by quote-unquote breaking Alexa's arm, her double-jointed arm. And we get that visual of her arm and her elbow being all mangled at SummerSlam. Now, it would have been so much more effective had we not seen them do this angle with Alexa. Not only once, but twice we've seen her do the whole double-jointed thing with her arm on TV. But that doesn't mean that it still won't make for a cool visual at SummerSlam. Or, you have ESPN running with some story about Ronda Rousey breaks opponent's arm and then it's plastered all over the place. I'm almost positive that's what they're going for, and that's the entire reason why they put the belt back on Alexa in the first place, which again is why I don't mind her being the champion again, and why I don't understand all these people freaking out like it's such a big deal. She's the Roman Reigns of the women's... Really? Really? Because last I checked, Alexa Bliss was cutting better promos than Roman Reigns. That's almost an insult to Alexa Bliss. I wouldn't go that far. And it's a very big difference, because with Roman, you know, the goal, I would think, is that they're looking to crown sort of their next guy by giving him this big win and big celebration. I'm sure that's what they would have wanted to do in the past, and Vince just keeps putting it off and putting it off. With Alexa, they're not trying to crown anybody. They're just putting the belt back on here so they can get it onto Ronda Rousey. So, again, I have no issue with this. Dolph Ziggler pins Seth Rollins in a 20-minute match, very good match, to win his sixth Intercontinental Championship. Rollins rolled up Ziggler much the same way he rolled up Elias at Money in the Bank to retain his title. But this time Ziggler reversed it into a roll-up of his own with a handful of tights, and he scored the pin. And they played this up as a huge surprise, which they should have because it was. It was a huge surprise. Not only to see Rollins lose the title on television, but to see him lose it to Dolph Ziggler, of all people. It's not something I was expecting. Now, I'm not sure what the point of this is, that being putting the belt back on Ziggler, if not to do one of two things. Either move Seth Rollins out of the IC title picture into the main event so that he can challenge Brock Lesnar for the Universal title, which is what I would do, or to build up a tag team feud with either Dean Ambrose or Jason Jordan coming to Seth's aid, both of whom, you know, have been partners with Seth in the past. Either one would make sense. Ambrose and Jordan are both due to come back and be back on television sometime this summer. I think Jordan next month. Ambrose may be closer to SummerSlam. I don't know. I'll be honest with you. If it were me, while I would... Yeah, part of me wants to see them continue to kind of finish what they started with Rollins and Jordan. Now that Chad Gable is back on Raw, and we see Chad Gable basically just being jobbed out to Jinder Mahal every single week, what a freaking waste of talent that is. I would actually rather they bring back Jason Jordan and have them reunite American Alpha. He comes back, he realizes his friend is on the same brand with him now, he goes to his father, he's like, Dad, I want a team with Chad, become the crown jewel of the tag team division, whatever the case may be. I would rather see Gable and Jordan put back together initially to try to maybe spice up the tag team division if they get serious about tag team wrestling on the show again. That's what I would rather they do with him. But I am cool with them taking the IC title off of Seth Rollins if it means Rollins against Lesnar at SummerSlam for the championship. The problem is, I don't see that being the main event of SummerSlam. I really don't. I think it's going to be Roman Reigns versus Brock Lesnar with Braun Strowman cashing in either during or after the match. They've already announced a rematch for Raw tomorrow night between Ziggler and Rollins for the championship. I'm thinking that this is going to extend out to the next pay-per-view. I think this is going to go all the way to Extreme Rules, so maybe there's a fuck finish tomorrow night. Whatever it is, I don't think we've seen after tomorrow the last of Rollins and Ziggler. I think this carries over into a stipulation match at Extreme Rules. And, you know, at least it goes that far. Kurt Angle, now this plays into the next item from Raw, the other big item, which was Kurt Angle announcing a multi-man match for Extreme Rules with the winner meeting Brock Lesnar for the championship at SummerSlam. Which, by the way, as I said a few weeks ago, it was laughable. All these rumors and reports that Brock's not going to be on SummerSlam. I said I would eat my hat if that actually happened. Of course, he'll be at SummerSlam. How could he not be? So, he will be at SummerSlam. He will defend his championship.
against the winner of this multi-man match. Roman Reigns and Bobby Lashley are already in. They even teamed up together on Monday night to beat the Revival. They were trying to one-up each other the whole time. Reigns was setting up for a spear. Lashley tagged himself in, and he won with a spear. Nice little FU there to Roman Reigns. Now, we don't yet know how many people are going to be in this match. Kurt didn't say if it's five. He didn't say if it was six. I figure it's one or the other. I think five is probably what it'll be. I think five is a nice round number. There is advertising out for Extreme Rules. This is a little bit of a spoiler. That has Braun Strowman and Kevin Owens earmarked for a steel cage match. So if we assume then that Braun Strowman, who has the briefcase anyway, and Kevin Owens are not going to be in this multi-man match, take them out of the equation. And if we assume Seth Rollins may be wrestling Dolph Ziggler or doing something with Ziggler and McIntyre at Extreme Rules, probably Ziggler, who does that leave? So I look at this and I say, we have Roman, we have Lashley. You got to figure Finn Balor is going to be in there. So that's three of the potentially five, let's say. Constable Corbin, who cleanly pinned Finn Balor with the End of Days on television Monday night. Okay. For that reason alone, I'm not enthusiastic about him being in the main event mix right now, but it would make sense for Corbin, who has some position of authority on this show, to put himself or tell Kurt, hey, Stephanie wants me in this match. So that's four, right? Roman, Lashley, Balor, Corbin. Who could number five be? And if it were me, number five would be Drew McIntyre. Remember, after Dolph won the IC title on Monday night, McIntyre was cutting a promo. He said this was the first of many titles to come. I think he would fit in there very well. He wouldn't win. It's not going to be McIntyre and Lesnar at WrestleMania, although that is a match I wouldn't mind seeing at some point. But he also doesn't have to eat the pin. It's a multi-man match, right? That's the beautiful part of these multi-man matches. They never have to make a decision one way or the other on who they're going to push. We don't want to beat this guy. We'll just make it a multi-man match. So I think it would be good to see him in there mixing it up with the top guys on the brand instead of just standing there as Ziggler's heavy in his corner for whatever match he's going to have. So that's what I see for Extreme Rules. We'll see if I'm right or wrong. Roman Reigns, Bobby Lashley, Finn Balor, Baron Corbin, and Drew McIntyre. I think Rollins absolutely belongs in there because he should be in the main event of SummerSlam, but I don't see him being a part of this. SmackDown on Tuesday, Twitter poll. Oh, let's see what we got here. 2,400, almost 2,400 votes. 86% thumbs up, 14% thumbs down. SmackDown had more votes than Raw did this week. That never happens. So apparently we have a lot of people observing Rusev Day who are very excited about this show. Just some quick thoughts on the opening segment. We had Carmella come out, still women's champion. James Ellsworth comes out once again, dressed up as Asuka, pulls the hood off. It was patently obvious this time, obviously, that it was not Asuka coming down to the ring. So the two of them are in the ring, and Ellsworth gets on the mic, and he's basically just talking about how Carmella is the best of all time. She's better than Asuka. She's better than Lita. She's better than everybody that's come before her, Charlotte, everybody. And Asuka comes out. She kicks Ellsworth in the gut. Carmella, though, with her distracted, hits Asuka with a super kick and leaves. I'll just say this. I really like the combo of Carmella and Ellsworth. I think it plays better with her having somebody there that she could play off of and that she could sort of talk down to because that fits her personality on the show. So I like the fact that he's back as her lackey, and I approve of this combo. Sanity finally made their SmackDown debut this week, minus Nikki Cross, who I do think will eventually link up with them. I just think it's going to take a little bit longer, but I think she will be part of Sanity down the road. They were scheduled on this show to fight the Usos, but the match never actually started. We had Eric Young, Alexander Wolf, and Killian Dane beating down Jimmy and Jay and leaving them for dead. Fightful.com had a very odd story about the announcers on this show being instructed not to mention anything about their past in NXT. That was a directive. Do not mention anything
about them and their history in NXT. The only explanation I can come up with to explain this, why this would be such a priority, that you would tell the announcers flat out, do not mention NXT, is that they just didn't want people thinking, hey, here's three guys from NXT. They wanted people to see three crazy dudes who have never been here before just sort of show up for the very first time and wreck shit. Plus, they were baby faces the last time we saw them in NXT. Now they're clearly back to being heels. Maybe that had something to do with it. It's not as though they make a habit out of ignoring people's past. Like, I would be really upset if they just completely ignored everyone's past in NXT, you know? And I'm sure Triple H would be frustrated by that as well. They really don't do it that often. Asuka had the undefeated streak. You almost had to acknowledge it when she came up. Kevin Owens, when he first came up, he was the NXT champion. And they put him over John Cena. And you could go through the, even guys like No Way Jose, you know, they mentioned when he debuted that he came from NXT. And so, it doesn't bother me. I mean, if that is the rationale behind it, I get it. I understand it. It makes them seem maybe crazier. There are a lot of people watching this show that don't watch NXT. You got to keep that in mind also. There are people and kids and whoever watching SmackDown. I don't know what the percentage is, only WWE does, but I guarantee you the vast majority probably of the people who watch that show on Tuesday probably do not watch and do not know hardly anything going on in NXT. And maybe that was the idea behind it. We want a fresh start for these guys. And if that's the case, then I'm okay with that. The Bludgeon Brothers beat Anderson and Gallows in a rematch for Money in the Bank. Only reason I mention this is because on their way back to the dressing room, as they're walking up the or down the aisleway, Daniel Bryan's music hits. He's on his way down to the ring for the main event gauntlet match to determine a new number one contender for the WWE Championship. And so he literally crosses paths with Harper and Rowan. They all stop. They stare at each other. They're staring Bryan down. Bryan's caught in the middle. And then he just, you know, continues on to the ring and the Bludgeon Brothers make their exit. I was immediately reminded, seeing this, of the history that these three obviously have. They were all former members of the Wyatt family. At first, I just thought it's a nice little sort of nod to the people who pay attention and remember their past. I didn't think it was anything more than that. So we'll get back to that in a second. Bryan beat Big E in the first match of the gauntlet, not before missing a diving headbutt off the top rope. That is the first time that he has tried that move since he unretired, and I really don't need to see him performing that move ever again. You know, for a guy who's been playing it, he has been playing it safer with a lot of his moves since he came back. He knows the risks that are involved. He knows that at any given moment, he could be retired all over again. You know, he really is. He's one injury, he's one concussion away from another forced retirement. And I just watched that and I thought, boy, that was a pretty fucking stupid thing for him to do. Please don't do that again. Next match, after Bryan beat Big E, he had to deal with Samoa Joe. And we finally got that one-on-one match between Bryan and Joe that we were deprived of a few weeks ago. We got Bryan and Joe this time one-on-one without the 7 feet of dead weight that they just cut. Joe destroyed Bryan's chest with chops. He almost broke Bryan's neck on a snap power slam. That was terrifying to see. Even more terrifying on the slow-mo, on the instant replay. I mean, they showed the replay. Bryan landed right on his head. It was very nasty. It could have been so much worse. So they ended up outside the ring. Joe locked on the choke. Bryan kicked off the barricade, flipped over to escape the old Bret Hart move, and he beat the referee's count of 10 back into the ring. Joe was not so lucky, and so he was stunned when he found out that he lost. I thought he was going to come back in the ring and beat Bryan senseless and basically leave him for dead for whoever was going to come out next in the gauntlet. But instead, the Bludgeon Brothers came back out through the crowd, and they beat down Daniel Bryan. They laid him out with their assisted powerbomb finish and left him for dead for The Miz, who rushed down to the ring like he was, you know, cashing in the Money in the Bank briefcase that he should have won last Sunday. He hit the skull-crushing finale, and he pinned Bryan to eliminate him from the gauntlet. And I like that. I like that a lot because they kept the interaction with Bryan and Miz obviously very limited. But it's another little thing that Bryan can eventually point to when he calls Miz a coward and the two of them eventually link up and have a feud. The deal with the Bludgeon Brothers is intriguing, although the problem is it makes it look like Brian is just going to be relegated to doing tag team matches. He'll be wrestling maybe for the tag team titles at Extreme Rules. My guess is it's just a way to kill time with him before SummerSlam. He's going to have a big singles program at SummerSlam. They don't know what to do with him. They're trying to protect him in the meantime, and so this is just something for him to do. Question is, if there is a tag team match, and I suspect there will be, who's his partner? Who does he team up with? Now, there's always his old buddy Kane, who has said that he is open still to wrestling, even if he does become mayor, although he won't be mayor until early August. Problem is, Kane is a Raw brand guy. But then again, it's not as though they haven't disregarded aspects of the brand split before. Would not be the first time if they do. And look, I don't need to see Kane teaming again with Daniel Bryan. I think we've moved beyond that. You could look at this and say, the one person who I would like to see, and I think would make for a cool tag team partner for Daniel Bryan, would be Samoa Joe. Of course, it makes no sense. It really doesn't make any sense. I admit that. I readily admit that. But it wouldn't take much. You know, you could always come up with a way to explain it by having the Bludgeon Brothers attack Joe. And maybe Joe and Bryan then are forced to come together as, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend type of situation. I think, though, if it does turn out to be Joe, I think what they should have done, I think what they should have done anyway here, you could have easily made sense of it by having Harper and Rowan interfere in the match and cause Joe to be DQ'd, and then Joe all of a sudden has a beef with them because these two guys, these two clowns, just cost him a shot at the WWE Championship. Problem is, they didn't do that. Bryan had already beaten Joe by countout. He embarrassed him with that finish. So why would he suddenly team with the guy that just beat him and embarrassed him? But I still maintain a Daniel Bryan Samoa Joe tag team at Extreme Rules, followed by the inevitable breakdown between them, and then a singles match, a true one-on-one singles match between them at SummerSlam, I think would be one direction that I would have no problem with. Rusev was the final man into the gauntlet, a Rusev and Miz final. They wrestled a few more minutes before a Machka kick and an accolade. Miz tapped out. Rusev is now the number one contender for the WWE Championship. He will meet AJ Styles at Extreme Rules. I could not be happier. If you are finding fault with this, if you are a Rusev fan, and yet you still find something about this that you didn't like, then I think it's time for you to pack up and find a new hobby. Because if you want something new, as far as, you know, the WWE title goes, if you are a Rusev Day fan, if you go to the building and you chant Rusev Day, if you bought the shirt, oh, they should be doing more with him, oh, it's criminal they're not doing more with him, and if you found any fault with what they did here at the end of the show, then you need to go find something else to do. I don't know what else they could possibly do in this particular circumstance to please you. This is exactly what people have been crowing for now for months. Do more with Rusev. Give him a shot. Well, now he's going to get his shot. He's going to be challenging for the top championship on the brand. Not the top title in the promotion. The WWE title hasn't been the top title in this company now for at least a year. I think the way that they have sort of downgraded this championship and the way that they've positioned it on the pay-per-views and such is disgusting. I mean, the IC title up until recently, I mean, now Ziggler has it, but up until recently, the IC title was ranked even higher than the WWE title in the eyes of many. Shouldn't be that way. But he's going to get his shot at Extreme Rules. Now, I believe, if I remember correctly, Rusev had a match on TV with AJ a few months ago that was really good. So I'm looking forward to seeing what they can do in really what is the biggest match of Rusev's career since the match with Cena at WrestleMania 31, even though that one was for the U.S. title. I still say that was a far bigger match because Rusev at that point was undefeated. He was the U.S. champion. He came out on a freaking tank at WrestleMania, for God's sakes. He was wrestling John Cena. That still, to me, is the biggest match of his career. But since that one, this would be the biggest for Rusev. And so we're going to see what he's capable of at the pay-per-view, and I'm sure it's just a one-off. I don't see him winning. I don't see this extending far beyond Extreme Rules. But for one pay-per-view at least, we're going to see what the guy's made of. He's getting a shot. I'm sure it'll be third or fourth down from the top when they lay out these matches. There's no way this is headlining the show. But I look forward to it. It should be good. Now, AJ came out for a stare down with Rusev. They shook hands. Aiden English extended his hand out to AJ, but then he pulled it away like he thought he was Ric Flair in the 80s. And so AJ punched him and knocked him down just as they went off the air. This all felt very different than what we would normally see them do, and I liked it. In this case, different was good, and I liked it. The gauntlet, I thought, overall was pretty good. It wasn't as good as the Raw gauntlet that they did earlier this year, but I still thought it was very good.
If you or a loved one are experiencing the following symptoms: smiling the night after you lose your championship, not demanding a rematch for a championship you never lost, inexplicably stopping and waiting at the top of a ladder for no reason, crying and begging for your job, getting distracted by an entrance during your match while ignoring your opponent who attacks and pins you, staying backstage when someone makes fun of your sister on live TV, then coming out smiling, being too afraid to wear a cup even after you've been low-blowed 10,000 times by the same man, you might be experiencing DBS, Dumb Babyface Syndrome. But fear not, you can be cured! Side effects may include standing up for yourself, becoming a pissed-off badass, higher merchandise sales, and more favorable crowd reactions. Talk to your doctor today. Unless your doctor is Dr. Aman, in which case, seek a second opinion. DBS, Dumb Babyface Syndrome. You can be cured.
There's not much to say about NXT this past week. It was one of these post-takeover shows that they tape from the arena, where they have a couple of matches and a whole bunch of video packages. So nothing of any great substance happened on the show. They also have the WWE UK tournament. It has already been taped. I'm not going to give away any spoilers here, other than the announcement that was made there at the Royal Albert Hall by Triple H and Johnny Saint. They have officially announced a WWE... I think they're calling it an NXT UK brand. And they're going to have, already have the UK title, but they're going to have a set of tag team titles and a women's title as well. So the brand has officially been launched. We don't know yet where the show is going to air, when it's going to start. I think they have some tapings already scheduled soon. So the UK brand is now officially a thing. As far as the results of the two nights, again, you can find the results online if you want to look that badly. I'm hoping I have time to watch both nights when they air on the network, and then I can sort of review it here on the podcast next week. If you do want to watch, it airs tomorrow and Tuesday. So Monday and Tuesday at 3 p.m. Eastern time is when each of the parts will hit the network, and then, of course, they will be archived on demand. Lucha Underground, Season 4, Episode 2 this week. We had Katrina teleporting to King Cuerno's home in search of the Gauntlet of the Gods. And she thought she found it, but when she looked, it was just an empty case. There was no Nintendo Power Glove inside, as I call it. Cuerno appears. He tells her that I gave it away to somebody for safekeeping. I don't know where it is, and so you're not going to be able to find it. And Katrina tells him, I need that glove. I need that gauntlet in order to get my life force back. And Cuerno says, and these are his words, I don't give a shit about whether or not you get your life back. And then she vanishes. That was very mean. I thought that was very mean. I will happily help Katrina look for her life force. I'm a very giving person. I'm all about helping others. We had a trios title match with the champion Son of Havoc, the Mac, and Killshot defending against Famous B's three newest acquisitions. Big fan of Famous B here. We've had him on the podcast before. And this time there was no Dr. Wagner Jr. There was no Tejano, the usual suspects, the usual clients. They were not around. Instead, we were introduced first to a man Famous B says he discovered when he took his caddy to the shop to be repaired or detailed. Big Bad Steve. That's what he calls himself. He comes out. He's dressed up like a mechanic. I guess he is supposed to be a mechanic. Matt Stryker, never one to miss a pun, said, I guess he's going to throw a wrench into things. Vampiro said, I don't like you at all. And Stryker says, that really grinds your gears, doesn't it? At this point, I was hoping Vampiro would like take a fork and put it through his eye or something, but he didn't do that. By the way, Big Bad Steve is also the one under the mask playing Pindar in the reptile tribe. And we've seen this before, you know, where they use somebody under a mask for one gimmick, and then maybe they get killed off or whatever, and then unmasked, they're portraying a different character. They did it with Mr. Sisko. He got killed off, I think, by Matanza. And then ended up playing one of the masked members of Paul London's White Rabbit tribe, so they've done this before. Anyway, out next was Sammy Guevara, who has been getting a lot of attention on the indies. He's only 24 years old. He's wrestled for Evolve, PWG, MLW. And so he is now, I guess, with Lucha Underground, at least for this night he was. And then came Famous B's biggest acquisition. He called this man the hottest free agent in the business. And I think Famous B needs to lay off the white powder, or maybe the Four Locos, or whatever he's been taking. Let's not get carried away here. But he brought out former WWE star and world champion, Jack Swagger, who now goes by the Savage Jake Strong. And there was a cool spot here towards the end where Strong was in there with Killshot. And he propelled Killshot up into the air the way that Cesaro does, or used to anyway, when he would, you know, before he would uppercut somebody. Remember those great Sami Zayn Cesaro matches in NXT? Wouldn't that be a feud you wouldn't mind revisiting one day on the main roster? All the more reason to put Sami Zayn on SmackDown, but I digress. So he propels Killshot up into the air. He lets him fall. Instead of letting him just fall face down on the mat, he grabs his ankle in midair, and when Killshot lands, he's locked in the ankle lock. I thought that was really cool. Killshot starts tapping out like a madman. Referee is distracted, though, by Famous B on the apron. What is he doing? So the referee doesn't see the tap. They have the match won. Big Bad Steve tags in. He gets stunnered by the Mac. He gets finished off by Son of Havoc with the Shooting Star Press. Champions retained. Strong was not happy at all about any of this. He was not happy with Famous B. He beat up Big Bad Steve. He beat up Sammy Guevara. And he puts Famous B in the ankle lock. And they played what I call the celery sound effect, where they snap a stick of celery in half to get that bone break effect. He broke Famous B's ankle. And if Famous B is listening, I have a great orthopedist that you can see. Just hit me up. As I said earlier, I'm all about helping others. Antonio Cueto announced that they are doing the Gift of the Gods again, meaning a series of matches for each of the 7 ancient Aztec medallions. First match was Drago against El Dragon Azteca Jr. Dragon Azteca won a medallion with a twisting roll. I guess it was an O'Connor roll, they call it. I've never seen an O'Connor roll off the top rope like this. He hit the frickin' thing off the top rope, gets the pin. And so Dragon Azteca has the first of 7 ancient Aztec medallions. So Cobra Moon, when the match is over, she is tending to Drago, yelling at Drago. All of a sudden, Johnny Mundo comes out. And Taya comes out. Taya attacks Cobra Moon from behind. They both beat the hell out of Drago and Cobra Moon. If you remember, as the announcers pointed out, it was Cobra Moon who unleashed Vibora of the reptile tribe, unleashed him on Johnny Mundo in last week's Aztec Warfare match. And so I guess this was their revenge. It feels like 2 steps down for Johnny Mundo, but maybe it's just a 1 or 2 week thing and he'll move on back up. We then had Antonio Cueto in his office. Suddenly, Katrina appears in front of him. How can I do that? Well, I just, like, snap my fingers or something? Is there, like, some kind of password or some kind of code I have to recite? Do I have to say Beetlejuice 3 times? How do I get her to show up here in front of me? Anyway, she appears. And it's funny, too. He says to her, "What are you? You some sort of phantasma?" She explains that she is stuck between this life and the spirit realm. And she asks him to book a Grave Consequences match next week between Mil Muertes and Phoenix so that he can kill Phoenix again and Katrina then can steal his life force and be free. I'm not really sure how killing Phoenix will get her life force back. It's very confusing to me. Maybe he's in possession of this glove. I don't know. But you get no arguments out of me. Another Grave Consequences match between Phoenix and Mil Muertes. You guys know that's my favorite match in Lucha Underground history. And so they're going to do it again next week. Main event was Pentagon Dark defending his Lucha Underground Championship against the monster, Matanza Cueto. And this was a total just chaotic brawl outside. They were outside the ring for the first, like, felt like 10 minutes of this match. Throwing each other into the, you know, all the chairs that are set up for the fans to sit in. And just a wild brawl. Finally, they get back in the ring and Matanza's just throwing him. I mean, that's what Jeff Cobb does, right? He suplexes people all over the place. So he's throwing Pentagon around. And anyway, fast forward a little bit here. Pentagon hits Matanza with not one, but two Canadian destroyers. Well, he calls them, they call it Mexican destroyers on this show. Not one, but two straight Mexican destroyers to Matanza. And then he hits him with a package pile driver for the pin. That was awesome. Actually, this whole match was awesome. But that finish, I like that finish a lot. And this, I believe, is the very first singles loss of Matanza's career in Lucha Underground. Post-match, Pentagon tried to break his arm, but Matanza powered out of it. Antonio Cueto came out, threatened Matanza. Matanza was very afraid of his father, and they went off to the back. Show closed with a vignette in Antonio's office where Jeremiah Crane walks in. And Crane wants a match with himself, Phoenix, and Mil Muertes. He says he wants to be the one to bury Phoenix and Mil Muertes, and then he can have Katrina back. And Antonio says, "You're willing to put your life on the line for a woman?" And Crane says, "Have you seen her?" And Antonio thinks about this for a second and says, "Good point." Exactly. That's what I say. He's not wrong. Anyway, he grants his request. He said they're going to call it the first ever three-way to the grave match. So basically, they're doing a triple threat grave consequences with Mil Muertes, Phoenix, and now Jeremiah Crane as the main event of next week's show. I would have loved for it to be one-on-one again, Phoenix and Mil Muertes, but I don't mind this. This is going to be, I have a feeling, I suspect, this is going to be a pretty freaking crazy match next week. So, I'm looking forward to it. If you have questions for the mailbag, we only have time for a few here, but keep emailing me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Always include your name and where you are from when you write in. Maybe even how long you've been listening to the Sound Off for. Richie from Long Island, New York. I wanted to get your thoughts on Jason Jordan. I think they missed the boat by giving Corbin the constable gimmick and not Jordan. While Jordan is constable, he could have overruled Kurt's authority by saying that it was Stephanie McMahon who wanted the show changed and run a particular way, when in reality we come to find out that it was Jordan himself making the changes on his own as revenge for his father sending him home. Do you think that would be a better idea than Baron Corbin being constable? What would your idea be to throw Jordan back in the mix upon his return? Well, I just talked about this earlier. You could slot him back in there as a partner with Seth Rollins, but I would rather see him be linked back up with Chad Gable. I think Jason Jordan's a young guy, and he's got a lot of future ahead of him here. I don't really see the need to rush him into being a main eventer or an upper main event. Like, your tag team division on the show needs a lot of help right now. You've got Chad Gable, who is drowning on this show. They're not doing anything with this guy. And Gable is every bit as talented. Why not link the two of them back up and let them go and have a run that they never had the chance to have on the main roster? American Alpha never did dick on SmackDown because they didn't give them a chance to. The Revival, they haven't done dick with them on Raw because they haven't been given a chance. Now, to be fair, they were hurt. Both members of the Revival got hurt. One right after the other. I think it was Dawson first, and then Wilder got hurt, and so they've got to sort of prove that hopefully they're not injury prone. But once they're able to do that, and the company feels okay, it's safe now to sort of put them in a meaningful program. They should be doing stuff with the Revival. They should be doing stuff with American Alpha. These were guys having kick-ass matches in NXT. And I get, hey, well, the main roster is not just about kick-ass matches, but you know, I could see where some people would see the Revival as being bland. I could see that. But Jordan, Gable, together, Gable in particular, Gable can be very funny. You want him to play sort of a little goofball type the way Kurt Angle did early in his career, he can do it. So don't tell me that, well, these guys only have a ceiling. They can only go so far. They're not going to work on the main roster. You haven't given them a chance. Give them a chance, and they will succeed. Put Jordan and Gable back together. There is unfinished business with them as partners and plenty of time to split them up and have Jordan go off and do something on his own again. I don't understand the need to rush. As far as Jordan being the constable, I like that idea. That could have worked. Obviously, it's not happening, but yeah, I think that could have worked. And then in the end, you have the big twist where, you know, we come to find out that it was all this act of revenge on his father, and then maybe it leads to a match with him and Kurt Angle. Yeah, you could have gone in that direction too. I don't mind Corbin being, it's a goofy gimmick. It's like Steve Austin being the sheriff. It's stupid. It's stupid children's nonsensical bullshit, but it does give Corbin something to do. He's not horrendous in the role. I just don't care to see Corbin wrestling in main events like we saw him on Monday. It just doesn't do anything for me. But I think for Corbin, it's a good role for him to be in. And you do want somebody in that role who can sort of counteract whatever Kurt is doing, which means right off the bat, it really should be a heel. And I don't know that, Jordan being sort of a babyface and only in the end is it revealed that he's a heel. I don't know if that makes as much sense, although I still think it could work. But no, I mean, I would keep Corbin in the role he's in. But Jordan, you link him back up with Chad Gable. Troy from Islip, New York. I know you're tired of having John Cena versus Randy Orton matches, but what if they had a retirement match at WrestleMania? Well, maybe in 10 years, I'd be okay with that. There's no need for there's no need for either one of those guys, though, to retire any time before then. Why would Randy Orton retire? He's practically half retired as it is. He's got a lighter schedule. He's probably still making seven figures every year. Why would he retire? That would be the dumbest thing he could do. He's not that old. You don't think John Cena can wrestle into his 50s? He's also part-time at this point. Why would he retire? Why would either of those guys retire? So we can have a retirement match where the loser comes back a year later? No, I don't want to see that. In a decade, I think that could be a good draw for WrestleMania. Right now, I don't need to see that. Carlos from New York, with the next big takeover being Brooklyn and the women's title most likely being defended, could you see Shayna Baszler dropping the championship and being called up after SummerSlam weekend and possibly aligning with Ronda Rousey going forward? I hope not. I sure hope not. First of all, Shayna is a heel, so I would not align her with Ronda Rousey right now. I honestly did not know what to expect, how the crowd would take to Ronda Rousey in WWE. I thought they would maybe troll her, you're not one of us, boo, give her the Roman Reigns treatment. They've taken to her. She has gotten over as a babyface. I would not do anything to tinker with that. I would not align her with somebody who has been positioned as a bully heel. I don't think the time for that is right. They are friends. They are, I'm sure, at some point. They're going to work together, team up together. We'll get that horsewomen match at some point. I'm sure all of that is going to happen down the road. But I don't think now is the time. And Shayna hasn't even been in NXT for all that long. I would not take the title off her right now either. Even SummerSlam weekend, I don't know. I don't know what the match is going to be. I don't know if it's going to be her against Kairi Sane. I don't know if it's going to be her against... who knows? Maybe like a Bianca Belair or somebody. Who knows what direction? Maybe Nikki Cross in a rematch. Not knowing what the match is, I don't think I would be so quick to get that belt off of her. And in fact, I think she could easily stick it out in NXT until WrestleMania weekend next year and then get called up maybe in the Superstar Shakeup. There's no need to rush her up. Nick in Newport News, Virginia. What are your thoughts on Sabu? I always wondered why he never had a bigger role outside of ECW. Do you think politics and his attitude ruined his chances for a more successful career? Yeah, I do. I think his injuries, I think his style, I think his attitude, if some of the stories over the years are to be believed, I think all of those things factored into why he never got a serious run, for example, in WWE. He did get a run, you know, briefly in WCW. And obviously he got over as a big star in ECW. And I don't remember if he was in other promotions like XPW. I mean, there were a lot of short-lived sort of hardcore promotions like that over the years. But I think it was just his style did not gel with WWE. It just, you know, just like New Jack. I've gotten questions. you know, do you think New Jack could have been a bigger star? Should, you know, why was New Jack never given a serious look by WWE? It's fucking New Jack. My God, I mean, look what this guy did. That would never work in WWE. What, are you out of your mind? Some guys just are not a good fit for what WWE expects out of their, you know, talents, for what they put out on television. And for what, you know, one reason or another, it just never worked out. But I think their style, and promos and all that kind of stuff just had a lot to do with it, more than anything else. And as far as politics, I don't know. I mean, I'm not aware of there being any particular reason that Sabu would have been held down, unless somebody had a grudge against them that I'm not aware of. I don't really think it had to do with politics. I think it had to do with this was a sick person who put his body through hell, and so did Mick Foley. But Foley didn't do some of the shit that Sabu did. Yeah, Sabu sort of built a reputation of being clumsy, you know? I mean, his botches became part of his, I guess, his charm, you could call it. But the guy would do insane things. He would take things too far. And again, maybe he had a piss-poor attitude. I don't know that you can blame politics for why he never got higher than he did. And actually, he did get a run briefly in WWE. I'm talking like he was never in there. I'm talking like a serious run. But he was technically in WWE. They did bring him in. You know, for the ECW revival, he had a match on TV with John Cena. But, you know, long term, was it really ever going to work out with him and the company? Yeah, probably not. I was never a big Sabu fan myself. I was never a big New Jack fan myself. I just never really cared for what they did. It wasn't my thing. It just never appealed to me. Luke, in Maricopa, Arizona, do you think Ted DiBiase would work today as the Million Dollar Man gimmick that we remember? I ask this because he bought people, he had a manservant in Virgil. Would this work today in WWE? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. First of all, Ted DiBiase having a black man as his servant, probably not a good idea. That would not go over too well today. That's number one. Number two, just the nature of the whole Million Dollar Man gimmick. I just am trying to visualize plugging that character into today's formula that they have for their shows, and I just don't see it working. I just don't see it working. He was able to kind of keep up the gimmick outside of the ring. They'd give him a stipend, right? You know that story. McMahon would actually give him wads of cash and tell him fly first class and fly around, you know, drive around in limos. Because they wanted him to live the gimmick outside. What a great gimmick to get, by the way. Imagine if you're on, like, gimmick day. You're all gathered backstage. You're waiting to see what you're going to pull out of the hat. Fucking Terry Taylor pulls out the Red Rooster. Probably wants to blow his brains out. Ted DiBiase pulls out the Million Dollar Man. Like, who got the better of that one? You know what I mean? So, I think you could do it. But I think it would end up being something along the lines of what happened to his son. His son just, it felt like a watered-down version of the Million Dollar Man. And part of it was, yes, his son is just not his father. But, I don't know, just the presentation in today's WWE, today's Monday Night Raw, I don't know. I just don't see it working. There's just something different about today's product where I don't think a gimmick like that would have gotten over the way it would have back then. And I don't know if it's the sort of the quote-unquote fall of kayfabe. I think it has as much to do just with the production of the show and what would and would not have been allowable. Even something, forget the whole idea of him having Virgil as a slave, for God's sakes, which is basically what he was. I mean, Jesus Christ, I mean, you're not going to do that today. But even something as seemingly innocuous as him kicking a basketball away from a young child and making them cry. Those were some of the vignettes that helped get him over as this, you know, villainous heel back then, made him so hateable. I mean, my God, he made this poor kid cry. They would never do anything like that on television now. Are you kidding me? Gonna make a kid cry? Can't do that. I mean, I'm just saying, that's probably their view on it. I don't care. Make the fucking kid cry. What do I give a shit? Just, you know, as long as you clue him in after the fact, give him a lollipop or something, he'll be fine, he'll live. But I could see that being sort of the mindset there. And yeah, I don't think DiBiase would have gotten over quite as well as he did back in the 80s if you tried to do the same thing today. And maybe in other promotions today it could work, but in today's WWE, I don't see it.
Keep sending in those questions to the mailbag. TheSolemnMonster@gmail.com is the place to send any and all questions that you may have for the mailbag. Your chances are exponentially better if you do include that information when you write in. I did mention that there was one thing I wanted to play here at the end of the podcast, kind of a little treat. I was hoping it would have been cool to have it on the show last week in honor of Father's Day, but better late than never. So I've been cleaning some stuff out, some of my mother's belongings, and I came across a cassette tape that I completely forgot we still had possession of, and it was not thrown away. And this was a cassette tape that was recorded, I'm trying to think what year it would have been. This was in the early to mid-90s, somewhere around the early to mid part of the 90s. And there was a situation at the time with our landlord. They were a bunch of just crazy people. Crazy people. The husband looked like the Unabomber. He would walk around this ratty t-shirt and, you know, scruffy beard, just this look of death in his eyes, and not the most fun person to be around. And they started some troubles and wanted us out of the apartment, and they had no reason to kick us out of the apartment, so it was a whole back and forth. It was not a fun situation. So anyway, they're looking to, I guess, I don't remember, sell the house or the apartment or what it was. They wanted us out of there. And they basically had a realtor hound us and harass us and call us and go after us. And, you know, my parents had no interest in speaking to this real estate agent. And so we basically just ignored all of their inquiries, all the phone calls. And it was this just tit for tat. I mean, I'm sure both sides had bad things that they did and bad things that they said. You know, there's never any innocent angel in any of these stories, but believe me when I tell you, these were some sick people. They were some sick puppies. So what this recording is of are some of the phone calls that we received from said real estate agent. I won't mention where he's from or anything like that for obvious reasons. I've edited the audio to black out the firm, the name of the firm, and his phone number, although I seriously doubt he still works there, but you never know. But I remember listening to this audio, and I always used to get a kick out of it because at the end, finally, after he's threatening legal action and all of this stuff, somebody answers the phone. But it's not my mother, who is, of course, naturally, he was looking for my mother. He wasn't looking for the husband. He was looking for the wife. What he got was my father. It's only about 2 minutes long. It's not that long at all. And I will caution you, the audio really doesn't sound good. The audio quality, this buzzing, you can hear it. You can definitely hear what's being said, but just be aware, this is not exactly HD audio here. This is probably from like 1994 or something like that, 1993, I don't know. So it goes back, it definitely goes back over 20 years, I'll say that much. But anyway, here is this fun little piece of audio from the olden days. Papa Monster picking up the phone when this real estate agent made one too many phone calls to the Solemnmonster residence. And peep the voice out here, the voicemail message at the beginning. It's a familiar voice.
Hello, we're busy at the moment, but if you leave your name, number, and a brief message at the beep, we'll get back to you as soon as we can. Bye-bye.
Miss Salmon, it's Lou from... It's important that you call me... Thank you. Miss Salmon, it's Lou...
Miss Salmon, what are we, a fucking fish?
Lou from... Obviously, it's very important that I speak to you. Please call me at... Thank you. Miss Salmon, it's Lou again from... I know you've been getting my messages. It really would be polite of you to call me to see exactly what we can discuss. If there's nothing to discuss, then we go to the lawyer stage. Call me, or we'll start with issuing summonses. Thank you.
Yes.
Is Mr. Salmon there?
Oh, this is her husband.
Yes. Yeah, how you doing? My name is Lou from...
Yeah.
Yeah, I really wanted to speak to you. I've been leaving a lot of messages.
Well, let me tell you something, Lou. We have nothing to discuss with you.
Nothing?
Nothing. I don't like your attitude. I don't like the phone calls.
cooperation. You know, when you...
There's no need to cooperate.
When you put down 20, 30 phone calls and you get no return calls, you get...
Well, a normal person would take the hint.
The hint?
Well, if somebody's not returning your calls, they have nothing to talk to you about.
All right, whatever it's got to be, it's got
to
be.
Right. You want to take me to court? Take me to court.
I'm trying to give you good advice.
Don't give me advice. I don't need you for advice, Lou.
We'll leave it in the hands.
You are not my attorney. I don't need you for advice.
We'll leave it in the hands of the lawyers and...
Exactly.
That's what you have to do.
Exactly.
That's fine.
Did you get my message from last night?
What message is that?
That I also filed to complain with the licensing bureau.
Look, hey, don't fucking threaten me. You can do whatever you like, all right?
I already did it. You're the one with the fucking threats, asshole. You're the one with the fucking threats. You like threatening a woman? Come over here and threaten me!
You pussy. You know, for my father, I will say that is an incredible amount of self-control that he showed there. Let the record show that he only cussed after the real estate agent cussed at him first. And once that happened, it was like the floodgates opened. But anyway, happy belated Father's Day to Papa Monster. Hopefully you enjoyed that little bit of throwback audio there. Keep sending in the emails, like I said. Follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster. And I am hopeful that I will be able to check out all of the UK action on the network this week, and then I could talk about it next week on episode 553 of the Sound Off, the final one, I believe, before the July 4th holiday, which is coming up very quickly. So until next Sunday, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a fantastic week, a fantastic end of June, and I will see you right back here for more Sound Off next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
They have Kane in the back. This is what he said. Tonight, I will delight as I enter the abyss with a fellow monster. But it is I who will climb out alone and with a smile across my face.
Oh, oh my God.
What do they think this is, Shakespeare?
I was driving yesterday, and some asshole double parks his car in the service lane.
I should have cut a promo the way the WWE would script one out for me. Why art thou parking like one's smelly orifice? I wish 1,000 deaths upon thee. Then I could do a fucking tope, and we could fade to commercial.
Solar Monster sounds off.
Since 2007, the Solar Monster sounds off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solo Monsters sound off.